Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights. Servicing Massachusetts and New Hampshire, their team is part of the Velux Skylight Specialist Network and is committed to helping improve the air quality in your home or business. You can learn more and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, two bombing attacks just outside Afghanistan's Kabul airport claimed the lives of 60 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members yesterday. What did the attacks indicate about America's exit strategy, and what do they tell us about how the Mideast nation is going to operate under the Taliban? GBH News analyst and Ground Truth CEO Charlie Sennett will join us to discuss.
I'm Jared Bowen, in for Jim Browdy. Brigham and Women's doctor Daniela Lamas has quite the side hustle as a co-producer for the Fox Hospital drama series The Resident. It's not her first rodeo in TV, and her recent piece for the New York Times delves into what shows like The Resident can teach us about health, medicine, and hope. That's coming up ahead on Boston Public Radio.
GBH is filling in for Jim Browdy, who is on vacation. Yesterday, as everybody knows by now, we had a horrible tragedy. ISIS-K set off explosions at the Kabul airport and at a nearby hotel, adding chaos to the already complicated evacuation effort out of the airport there. The attacks killed dozens of Afghan civilians and at least 13 U.S. service members and injured many more. President Biden pledges to retaliate. Joining on the line to talk about what this means for the August 31st evacuation deadline and what retaliation could look like is Charlie Sennett. He's a news analyst here at GBH, where he heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie has covered Afghanistan for years. He was recently in Kabul at the time the Taliban was just starting to gain control of the more remote parts of Afghanistan. Charlie, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Sure. Sure. Tough day,
Marjorie. Oh, gosh.
Heavy day for our nation and for Afghanistan.
So what is the latest, Charlie?
Well, the Pentagon briefing is underway right now, and, you know, they're just continually briefing all of the press corps about sort of the ongoing airlift, very international in its scope. You know, this is countries who formed the NATO alliance that was part of the United States mission in Afghanistan. A lot of people involved in this, a lot of different countries, Spain, UK, Germany, many others, and a lot of regional approach to this too. But I think the only thing I heard that was really news coming out of it was they were correcting the record that it was one bomb blast, not two. They believe there are two people involved who are in their sights, as has been said. That is important information, but it's still just an extraordinary day, one of the most deadly days in the 20-year history in Afghanistan for the U.S. presence there, for America's longest war, 13 service members killed, more than 100 Afghans killed. And this is just an extraordinary day of mourning for those families who are our service members who lost loved ones, but also for Afghans. This is you can't imagine the panic and the chaos and the feeling of the uncertainty for their future going on with the people we're in touch with inside Afghanistan.
Well, Charlie, speaking of that future, we should remind people that you were just in Afghanistan very recently. But this is also it's a day of trepidation, and we saw how sober and grave the president was yesterday. We understand from intelligence reports that this something like this was very much expected. The suicide bombing. We know that the threats are still out there. That they were very strategic in targeting the airport in this gate where so many people had gathered with their documents to try to do whatever they could to get out of the country at the airport. So knowing that these threats still exist that could further encumber rescue and efforts to get troops and Afghans out of the country, How effective can the U.S. be in these next 4 days?
It's a really hard question, Jared. I mean, the truth is these servicemen who are there guarding the perimeter of the airport are right up against the Taliban, the former enemy. This is an incredibly difficult mission, made much more difficult and perilous by the active and real-time assessment of threat that there could very well be more of these attacks by ISIS-K. So I think if the question is, like, how do they stop this, I don't think they can, to be honest. I mean, we have the Taliban protecting the outer cordon, and then it comes right up against our servicemen who are there on, you know, along the wall, along the fence, and it is almost impossible to imagine how this is going to happen, particularly if you think ahead for a few days. When we get to the end of the month, the final evacuation is going to be very difficult to imagine. How do they get those final troops on to the cargo planes and up and out, trusting that the Taliban will secure the airport then, not just the perimeter of the airport, but by that point, they'll be turning over control of the airport. This is a choreography of risk that is impossible to really fathom. We have an amazing military, of course, but this has not been planned well. This has not had the elements of the excellence of our military that we have grown to rely on. But this is not a well executed moment. Things happened the way the military didn't plan it. Who could see it coming? I'm going to tell you, I didn't. I was on the ground. No one could have predicted an army of 300,000 would collapse in 11 days and that the government would buckle along with it. I didn't see that, and I guess I sort of relate to those in the military brass and even in the White House who are saying this has been part of an assessment of how we're going to do this, but nobody saw it happening this fast. I think that's – we got to give them that as a fair assessment, that I was not hearing that inside the Pentagon. I wasn't hearing it in Afghanistan. But certainly we should have been prepared, and there was the possibility. It couldn't have been ruled out, as one senior Pentagon official told me. It couldn't be ruled out an imminent collapse, and we weren't prepared for it. We're not prepared now, and I don't understand the plan because they haven't shared the plan.
Charlie, we want to talk to you about what we know about ISIS-K in just a second. But before we get to that, you know, on the other hand, this is a mess, obviously. But on the other hand, we've gotten tens of thousands of people out of there in a very short amount of time. And I don't recall in my history many other wars where we went in and rescued tens of thousands of people that were living in the country that lost the war and were going to face terrible consequences for that. You know, I mean, this is an unusual thing that we're doing. I don't know if unprecedented is correct or not, but it is pretty incredible.
It's a historic moment for sure. I mean, you're absolutely right, Marjorie. I mean, all of us, you know, go back to those images of Vietnam.
Exactly.
And of the final pullout and of the way we left so many behind in Vietnam who were then rounded up and put into what were really almost like concentration camps, or others who took, you know, to shaky rafts to get out into the waters to try to get to anywhere, to Thailand or to anywhere they could in order to try to make it to the shores of other countries. And many of them, as we remember, ended up in the United States, and it was a kind of really ragged refugee crisis that came in here and that went around the world. I think that was equally poorly planned. It was a longer, slower drawdown, and it was maybe marched forward in a different way. But it was no less heartbreaking to watch when the United States military accepts what I think you'd have to call defeat, you know, or certainly not a victory. They accomplished many aspects of the mission. But if they want to narrow it down to really, you know, putting the Taliban out of governance and making sure Al-Qaeda was disrupted and bringing Osama bin Laden to justice, those goals, you could argue, were accomplished a long time ago. So if you're trying to say we accomplished our goals, that's great. But then what was after bin Laden was brought to ultimate justice, then why did we stay in for another 10 years? And I just come to the end of this thinking deep questions around whether or not it was worth it. And I want to pose a story that asks that question big. We talked about it the other day, Marjorie. But it's this school that's got a great connection to Massachusetts. And just as a quick reminder to listeners, a guy named Peter Goodrich was a software engineer in 2001 on his way to work in California, got on one of the flights that was going to California, which was hijacked. It was crashed into the South Tower. He was, of course, killed. His family wanted to do something in his memory. So his mom was a school teacher, Sally Goodrich, his father, Don, lawyer. They built a school really in his memory in Logar province in Afghanistan. I've been in really close touch with the family of the principal who runs that school and some of the teachers involved in that school. And we have basically seen the Goodrich family and tried to help them where we could really execute getting that principal out in one of the most harrowing journeys I've seen. She was right at the Abbey Gate with her family, her children, and her husband. They were right in the peril of that moment where that threat of a bombing was very real. And thankfully, she got out just before that. She arrived yesterday in Germany. We just got pictures from them about 15 minutes ago of them in Germany. And just this sense of, you know, it's not over yet. They're on a long journey as refugees, but they are feeling awfully blessed to be out, and then deeply troubled, as they shared with me right away, about who they left behind, the students, the other teachers, what's going to happen to that school. And I think, you know, the Boston Globe let me really write a piece that allowed me to think about 20 years of coverage of this war. I was really, you know, there from the beginning, and I think that story of this school and the way it was in such direct harm's way, it was really at the intersection of a critical battle from Logar into Kabul, and the school was shot up, the Taliban took it over and operated out of it, and the principal was fleeing for her life. And just kind of thinking about that story as a microcosm of everything going on, I hope for listeners it makes it really come home for a real Massachusetts story that begins in Sudbury, honoring a victim of 9/11, the best of intentions, and now real questions around what's going to happen to that school, what's going to happen to those students, what's the future of this country.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett. Charlie, as you mentioned at the top, there is a Pentagon briefing happening right now where they just said there are still specific credible threats. Presumably, some of those threats come from ISIS-K, the group that has taken responsibility for the suicide bombing that has resulted in these deaths in Afghanistan this week. But this is the first a lot of the world is hearing of ISIS-K. Can you tell us what ISIS-K is and how it exists in relation to the Taliban?
Yeah. So, first of all, ISIS-K is sort of a faction of the ISIS we came to know in Syria and Iraq. And remember, they at one point had an emirate that they were controlling, and they had the black flags. And this was really kind of a horrifying moment until there was a really concentrated effort to defeat them. That was really thanks to Kurdish forces with U.S. air support, pushed them back, crushed their control of those areas, liberated people. But ISIS is also an idea, the same way Al-Qaeda was an idea. It's an extreme version of militant Islam, and it's really thrived in the Afghanistan context in Pakistan, just across the border. It has reconstituted itself. It was really on the back foot about 2 years ago. There are reports that it's been resurgent. They've had attacks they've claimed responsibility for. And they have the same idea that there is going to be an Islamic State, an emirate. And they are more militant about forcing any Western influence out of the country of Afghanistan, more militant, if you can believe it, than the Taliban, and also an enemy of the Taliban. The Taliban sees them very much for what they are, which is they're going to do whatever they can to cause violence, disruption, chaos, killing, because they have these sort of almost apocalyptic goals of an Islamic caliphate. They're small, but they're deadly, they're unpredictable, and they're really on the march. And I think we have to really, really say that this is a deep concern. They could strike again in these last few days. So how this plays out with the Taliban's security forces, and they don't exist yet. They're in complete disarray. To think the Taliban has control of the country is crazy. They don't have any control. It is a place out of control. So ISIS-K, the K, if people want to know, refers to Khorasan, which is a part of Afghanistan that has a Quranic reference for the geography of an area of Western Afghanistan. And it's very much referenced in the Quran. So they're very much fundamentalists adhering to this idea that this is a land that should be referenced as it is in the Quran, not in its modern context of names of cities and places that they wouldn't even recognize. They go by the Quranic references and the Quranic names, and that's where the K comes from.
So, Charlie, if ISIS-K is as we know, they are responsible for this attack that left both Americans and Afghans dead this week. How does this put the U.S. and the Taliban in the same league? In a sense, are they? You know, I don't know if this is the right term, but are they allies for the moment?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a famous axiom of that part of the world: the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And never has it been more ugly and truthful than in this moment right now, as the United States is trying to get out of Afghanistan, when its enemy, the Taliban, is recognizing that it has an enemy it shares with us, which is ISIS-K. And I think the Taliban are going to have to bring ISIS-K under control, because they're going to keep coming, and they're going to keep coming after them. The United States is going to have to, and this is so discomforting, and I can't help but feel for those servicemen and women and Marines who are right on the edge of this. This is a really flawed mission they have been given, right? I mean, this is almost impossible to imagine how this is going to play out. So you're right in the sense that there is this alliance of necessity. Enemy of my enemy is my friend, as they say. And they're going to have to work with the Taliban to keep ISIS at bay, right at the seam where they face each other now, to try to keep some semblance of control for a country that is panicking and doing anything it can to push to those gates and try to get out. And it's going to have to do some kind of harrowing, cardiac-inducing, like, investigation of ISIS-K now to try to thwart any attacks that may be in motion. And we are very compromised in our ability to stop those attacks because we've pulled back. We've pulled back a lot of our intelligence, our assets. We're starting to face a world in which we will no longer have eyes on the ground the way we have had in Afghanistan, and it will pose a threat to us. They will try to reconstitute and regroup in the chaos of this uncertain time in Afghanistan, and ISIS-K is a real threat. And we're going to have to actually, yes, as ugly as this is, try to work with the Taliban in the shared interest of getting ISIS-K put out of business or at least stopped for now.
Well, President Biden says he's going to retaliate against ISIS-K. How realistic is that?
I don't see how that isn't just our president, who is one of the most emotive people we've ever had in the White House, and recognizing tragedy and feeling it for real. I thought his speech was very personal and very powerful about him as a human being. But the words he said sounded good, but I don't understand at all how he's going to deliver on that promise. We don't have that intelligence. We have the over-the-horizon capability, but that's far away, and it requires a lot of fuel and time to get from where you make the risk assessment to where you fly in with a drone operation and try to take someone out. Time is of the essence. It is the essence of an actual counterterrorism operation. And as we shift from counterinsurgency against the Taliban to counterterrorism against ISIS-K, I don't think it's realistic that President Biden is going to be able to live up to those very emotional and, I'm sure, heartfelt words of promise. I just don't know that we're going to have the capacity to deliver on that promise.
Of course, it took us a long time to find Osama bin Laden, too, didn't it, Charlie? It was years, right?
And you know, it did, but I would say it was years, but it also was a focused effort, you know, by President Obama, unlike President Bush before him, who saw that bringing him to justice was what he vowed to do, what he promised to do, mm-hmm. and what he executed in doing. And that required crossing into Pakistani airspace,
right,
and taking that mission out without telling the Pakistani government. And it was really a bold and very risky operation. I really think President Obama deserves extreme credit for carrying that out and doing what he said he would do. We have so much to analyze. You know, they talk about after action review. We have to 20-year after-action review. And the way I look at it 20 years out is that we have just made a misstep every time. We came in 2001. Our country had been attacked. I'm not a pacifist. I believe we had to respond in order to protect our country. we did that, and it is worth remembering all these years later that we have not had a September 11th-like attack since then. But we lost our focus. We turned away from Afghanistan when we, I believe, history has recorded this as one of the worst disasters we've ever made was to invade Iraq. That was an unnecessary war, and it distracted us from the mission that we were making some success in Afghanistan. When we did that, we allowed the Taliban, which had been pushed across the border into Pakistan, to regroup, to reconstitute itself, and to surge back. And then when we finally had the long fight with the surge and bringing Osama bin Laden to justice, we had another moment there where we had a lot of troops on the ground. We had the upper hand, and we could have right then said, we have mission accomplished. With bin Laden brought to justice, we're now going to pull back. President Obama didn't do that. He stayed in. We then had President Trump, who I think made a huge mistake in telegraphing a deal without any real involvement of the sitting government.
Right.
And he was negotiating with the Taliban. And then we have seen that you know, I would say President Biden had the right instincts to end this, and he's been saying it for 10 years, and he finally had the chance to do it as president. But he failed in not coordinating a concerted effort in the end. In other words, four presidencies, lots of blame to go through all of them. It's unfair to dump it all on Biden's doorstep. But it's also a reflection we have to make that we have failed once again when we confuse ourselves with an invading empire or a nation-building supporters of democracy. We lose the plot. We forget our mission. And now we have two big examples in history, tragic examples, Vietnam and Afghanistan, that stand as the American military's losses. And they're going to now really shape our foreign policy going forward, because I really think we've put ourselves in a weakened position in this really, you know, poor exit strategy at the very end.
Charlie, let me ask you about that, because now considering the next chapter, this is what I was weighing yesterday as I was watching the president and that very forceful language, we will hunt you down and make you pay. Obviously, the U.S. wants to show its might at a moment where its might has basically been decimated as it's withdrawing from this country. But at the same time, you wonder, or at least I did, how you use language like that without feeling like you're entering into yet another kind of conflict.
Yeah, it's a very, very good observation, Jared. And I would just say one way we might think about it is what we're doing as a nation, what the White House is doing, what the military is doing, what the CIA is doing, and what we all need to understand is this is a shift. We're going from counterinsurgency to counterterrorism. That's a really important strategic and tactical difference that I think President Biden was referencing. One thing I should say, just because I'm so often, you know, we get things wrong in the media and we predict things that don't happen. There is a possibility that the Taliban will work hard to find who did this bombing and help the United States bring them to justice. It's a possibility. It's a long shot. I don't trust the Taliban. But I do think there is a possibility of those sort of mutually aligned interests could come together for President Biden to live up to that very understandable promise that comes from a deep place in all of us to want to have justice when our forces are attacked and when innocent people, Afghan people, are killed.
Charlie, thank you very much for your analysis today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, you guys. Tough day. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. Indeed, it is. Charlie Sennett joins us regularly. He's a news analyst here at GBH, where he also runs the Ground Truth Project. Coming up, we're continuing the conversation about Afghanistan with you. We'll take your calls about the situation there, where a terror attack amid the U.S. withdrawal marked the deadliest day for our forces in the nation in a decade. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. So this is America's vowed to leave Afghanistan, as we said before, by August 31st. The Taliban wants us out by then, too. But an ISIS-K attack on the Kabul airport that we've just talked about with Charlie Senate has left dozens dead. President Biden has promised retribution for the attack, saying, "We will hunt you down and make you pay." The U.S. forces say they're expecting more attacks to come. There's a press briefing going on right now from the Pentagon. Meanwhile, we want to hear from you. What does this mean for Biden's August 31st deadline for full withdrawal from Afghanistan? How do you see Biden's handling of the situation? Do your views align with a recent poll that shows that Biden's approval rating is plummeting in the wake of this tumultuous and now deadly situation? Give us a call at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You can email us at bprwgbh.org, and you can also tweet us at Boss Public Radio. As you know, between 13 service members were killed, 18 injured. More than 90 Afghans are dead, reportedly 28 members of the Taliban, although others are disputing that number, and at least 150 people have been wounded. 877-301-8970. What do you think, Jared?
Well, it's just obviously such a desperate situation, especially if you watch the footage with just how many people are lined up outside that airport or had been lined up outside that airport. You can almost see the desperation on their faces. I was watching the network news last night, and you know, the Afghan citizens are holding up their passports, their documents, whatever they needed or that they were told that they needed to bring to the airport. Of course, now we're hearing that it's really difficult for so many other people to get to the airport. And now so many people are told to go home. You can't go there because of these threats, because of the suicide bombing and because of the imminent threats that the Pentagon is confirming right now continue, saying that they are specific and credible threats against Kabul and the evacuation effort. And it just, I think like everything else, is it just all happened so quickly, you know, and there are questions about how we could not have been prepared for these eventualities as well.
And as we were just talking about, I mean, how do these last American service people get out of there is really quite frightening to contemplate as well. Before we take your calls at 877-301-8970, we talked to two congressmen from Massachusetts, both of whom are Marine veterans. Seth Moulton, as you know, has been taking some grief lately for going over to visit the airport at Kabul. We talked to him last week, though, before his visit to Kabul, about this whole escape and evacuation from Afghanistan. Here's Congressman Seth Moulton.
It's a wholesale betrayal. And we've got to turn this around. It is still within the power of the president and the United States of America to save thousands of innocent lives.
Moulton was basically very critical of Biden's handling of this evacuation from Afghanistan. We also talked to Congressman Jake Auchincloss earlier this week on Tuesday about the same situation.
What we have seen is we have seen a president prevent us from being in Afghanistan 50 years hence. Now, this is a country whose moniker is the graveyard of empires, so the withdrawal was never going to be smooth sailing. Significant mistakes absolutely have been made.
He was obviously a lot more forgiving, I suppose, of President Biden, who, is, as we just mentioned, is taking a big hit all over the country for his handling of this. So 877-301-8970, bprwgbh.org, or tweet us at Boss Public Radio. Let's start with Dave in Brookline. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Wow. First call. So I think that I don't know that Biden – I'm certain Biden could have handled this better, but I also don't think that he had a crystal ball. But I think we have to remember that Trump released the Taliban's de facto leader from prison, and Obama continued Bush's war campaign, and Bush invaded Afghanistan, and Reagan armed the Mujahideen, who became the Taliban. So this is all just a big cluster, you know what, that's been going on for a little more than 40 years. And I just don't see, even though how Biden has been in the Senate since the early 70s, how I just don't know how this could play out differently from how it is. I mean, you know, American troops and coalition troops have been in Afghanistan for 20 years and nothing's really any better. And there was no ISIS until we invaded Afghanistan. So I just don't see how he can take the rap for this entire thing when there are a lot of hands, when there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen for this particular mess.
Dave, thank you for the call. We should say, though, what is better in Afghanistan? Obviously, at the beginning of this war, we saw women getting hauled out into stadiums and be shot and beheaded. They were unable to have any kind of freedom at all. That has changed dramatically. You have young women who have grown up in Afghanistan who are able to go to school and get an education and go to work. Obviously, that's different. Now, the Taliban says they're going to be able to keep working. We'll see. I mean, there's a lot of suspicion about that. There was an economy that was rebounding. So, you know, the United States presence there did help Afghanistan. I don't think there's any question about that. The question is, should we be nation building in other countries when we're not doing much nation building in our own country? And were we ever in a position to understand, as Andrew Bacevich, who's writing, I adore, he's at BU, he's a career military guy. He lost his son in this 20-year battle. He says, you know, we should question our own American so-called exceptionalism, whether we really have any business doing these kinds of things. Even though, as Charlie said, the tragedy with those schools is really, those girls' schools is really hits home.
But, you know, the other thing, and I mentioned this the other day, too, is that the consistency of Joe Biden. Yeah, I've mentioned that I'm reading Barack Obama's memoir right now and had just finished reading this weekend the passage about Afghanistan, where he was talking about how Joe Biden was the outlier in the Obama administration because he didn't want this war to continue, and how it became very problematic, actually, in the Obama administration for the way that Joe Biden got in front between the administration, the White House, and the Pentagon. And there was kind of an obstruction there. And now we see, of course, he's following the Trump path about withdrawal, but it's one of the first things he's doing as president is to get the troops out of the country.
And one other thing before we get back to the calls, I've read conflicting things about the so-called disastrous Afghan army. That one of the problems there was very similar to South Vietnam, that the corruption in that government there was so overwhelming. There was one of the Afghan generals wrote this great piece. Obviously, it's self-serving. He's an Afghan general, but he talked about how and Americans have said this too, how a lot of these Afghan fighters were extremely courageous. But when the corruption was such that you were left without bullets for your guns and without food for your soldiers in these outposts somewhere, and you were not going to get any support, and you saw the stealing going on in the higher levels of government, part of you is saying, what am I laying my life down for? So, I think that we'll have to look back on history to see whether the Afghan army should have lasted longer, those 300,000 fighters we always talk about training. You have to at some point say, like it did in South Vietnam, what am I fighting for exactly? Eric from the car, thank you for calling.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Thank you. It's a tough day, Eric,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's a tough day. It's especially tough for the people on the ground. I started working with some refugees about a month ago, putting together visa applications.
Good for you.
Yeah, well, I spent time on the ground as a Marine about 15 years ago, so I've got a lot of passion for the people of Afghanistan. And, you know, we started to help to try and help those people and put together applications. And, you know, that really morphed into a crisis management program here about 10 days ago when our families moved into hiding in Kabul when the Taliban moved in. So we've been working to try and move people around safely, get them to and from the airport. You know, these names like Abbey Gate and Baron Hotel are very familiar to us. We've been moving people in and out and around those places for about a week now. It's really been horrific for the people on the ground, even before these suicide attacks, which in some ways were kind of seen as inevitable from our people on the ground. So it's just tragic all around.
Well, Eric, I'm curious, what is the effect that the suicide bombing has now had on trying to get people moved around? Is that just shut down, or do you think there are still ways to get people out?
So it's very dynamic. So the options for – there's different categories of people. There's U.S. citizen green card holders. Those people have been, over the past week, moving – effectively through the gates, both on civilian side, military side. Taliban's allowed people, if they show U.S. documentation, to move through. People need to understand the Taliban has been controlling the airport. They're in the airport with checkpoints. I've had people being turned around at the terminal that have gotten through gates because the Taliban, it weren't on Taliban's manifest. So they're the ones running the show. They've been cooperative to allow U.S. citizens, but over the past week or so, they've really kind of locked up, not allowing any Afghan nationals with visa applications pending. There's different categories, but for those people, it's been really almost impossible. from the airport a few days ago as a viable exit strategy to looking at evacuation over the ground, which is basically what we've completely turned to at this point.
Well, Eric, thank you for your good work on behalf of these people and obviously for your time in the Marines. Thank you for the call as well.
Thank you.
877-301-8970. Again, I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna here, but I don't think we should forget that 105,000 people have been taken out of there in the last 12 days. And that is a credit to the military that's been on the ground helping people. I don't know, based on what Eric said, you don't want to give it too much credit to this horrible Taliban, but 105 people have gotten out of there and they've gotten through the Taliban to get out of there.
And what our forces are going through right now, if you read some of these depictions, the only way that they can have a sense if there's a security threat is basically not, I think I saw one description, not until the person's breath is on you do you really have an idea when it's a suicide bomber. So what these men and women are going through right now to conduct these evacuations and keep things as safe as they possibly can is extraordinary.
Right. And you remember a lot of these stories about these suicide bombers. I mean, a lot of them are very young and get kind of, I think it's fair to say, coerced into these horrible situations. I mean, can you even imagine doing something like that? Joan from Plymouth. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Marjorie. Hi, Jared. Couple of things. I don't know if either of you got an opportunity to read the Inspector General's report on Afghanistan. But
no,
I
didn't.
Parts of it, and it's a huge eye opener.
You mean the Afghanistan
so
papers about the lies? You mean
no?
Oh, okay.
No. It's the Special Investigator General's report on Afghanistan.
Oh, okay.
The Inspector General's name is John Sopko.
Yeah.
And he's been on Rachel Maddow, and he's been on CNN and so forth, but his insights and kind of summary of everything that has gone on in Afghanistan over the last 20 years is real eye-opening.
What is it?
So that's kind of one point. I mean, it's just everything. It's just the waste of money, the lack of vision, the lack of coordination, the chaos, all of it is exposed in there. And the corruption, is just huge. And, Congress basically ignored it, despite multiple appearances in front of the congressional committees and so forth. They basically ignored what they were told. If you're interested, I'm sure you can look it up online.
Well, I should point out that the Afghan papers I referred to, Joan, talked about how basically four presidents have lied to us, too, about what's been going on over there. And that's one of the things that Biden is, despite what's going on over there now, has gotten some credit for being, as you just pointed out in the historical record of what he said during the Obama administration, was much more get out of there. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, he held firm to that, yes.
But anyway, Joan, go ahead.
Yeah. So, no, I just think that that's a worthwhile report to reference as you go, as you continue thinking about this. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I think Joe Biden, despite what a lot of people are saying about how this has, the exit has been messy, and I agree it has been messy, and it's been really unfortunate and horrible to think about what's happened to all these people. But I got to give the guy credit. I mean, he is standing firm, and he is getting us out of there. And it's nothing but a big boiling mess over there, and we're not going to do any good staying there. So, yes, it's a mess. It's a horrible thing. But I think Joe Biden is showing a lot of backbone, and a lot of others, including Seth Moulton, by the way, are not showing backbone. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Joan, thank you very much for the call. Yeah, I think Congressman Moulton has been hammered from coast to coast on this, although I saw him on television last night, and he is absolutely strong in his position that he felt that was a lot of lying going on from the Biden administration. He wanted to see for himself what was going on. So,
all right. Well, we are talking about Afghanistan, asking for your thoughts about the chaotic evacuation of tens of thousands of Americans and Afghan allies amid the Taliban takeover and now deadly terrorist attacks. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are talking about this tragedy that has unfolded and is still unfolding in Afghanistan. at the airport in Kabul. Thursday's terrorist attack marked the deadliest days for United States forces in a decade. 13 U.S. service members killed, dozens of Afghan civilians as well, members of the Taliban, according to reports, as well. How does this development affect President Biden's self-imposed August 31st deadline? How does his handling the situation impact your view of the commander-in-chief? And what is your take overall on what is going on there now and what has gone on there before? Let's go to the phones, 877-301-8970. Jonathan from Groton, thank you for calling.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I guess, kind of bring to, attention or to the past history of the United States and their European allies going into other countries and, I guess, kind of imposing, you know, their way of doing things on these other countries when it just doesn't fit. You know, what business do we have in Afghanistan, let alone any other country, again, trying to make our culture fit to other people and whatnot.
Yeah, well, Jonathan, I mean, you're singing the song of a lot of people. I mean, I think obviously we were in Afghanistan originally about the attacks of 9/11, but you know, you got a great point. I mean, we are trying to impose on another country, different culture, one that in many cases is operating like it's the 7th century, you know, our vision of how government should run. And obviously it didn't work. And it hasn't worked, in, as you point out, in many places around the world where we've tried to do that. And that's why I'm always quoting Andrew Bacevich. I mean, I'm not a military expert, needless to say, but he makes a lot of sense. Where do we get off doing that? Are we running things so well here?
Right, well, you're both making me realize. You think back to the early days of Afghanistan, and one, yes, it was about eliminating any further security threats against the United States, but it was also this noble effort that we were going to make to go into this country and bring them education and protect the rights of women, and these very lofty goals that I think a lot of people wanted to rally behind at the time, because it was about helping and saving people, but. As Jonathan and others have pointed out, history rhymes and it never really ends that way for nations who do this.
Jonathan, great points, and thank you very much for the call. The number is 877-301-8970.
Let's go to James in, I think it's Winchester. Hi, James.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I'm calling because I find it weird that we had this plan for over a year. Everyone knew about it. And why... They knew the dates they needed to be exited by, and there's so many Americans and so many people are still there, and they didn't plan ahead. And I was listening to the television last night, and there was a group from California with kids and their parents who were stuck over there.
Oh, gosh, yes. That was crazy.
And the government tells them they can't travel there. Now all these people are putting our military into harm's way to go save them and go after them. I mean, the President Trump made the arrangement with Taliban, don't shoot us, don't cause any injury to our Americans, and we'll be out by this time. And that's what President Biden's doing. He's following those rules, because if he doesn't, then the Taliban is just going to start doing suicide attacks. And I just don't understand why they're putting our military in danger by not planning ahead and moving out. They knew we were going to get out.
Well, in terms of the kids, I they're over there. There are high school kids with their teachers. Now they're Afghanis, James. Correct? Visiting family members over there.
They said they're American citizens.
Well, they may be American citizens, but they're visiting family in Afghanistan, so they're obviously they came from there. But this just does not seem like a wise time to go over on a visit to Afghanistan. From my understanding, several of them had gotten out, and some of them were still there. But that was really concerning. But in the other case, you know, what I've read is many people have been trying to get out of there for a decade, and they just can't. We have not been that friendly to immigrants from other countries, James, particularly from Afghanistan, right, for quite some time. So people have been like 5 and 10 years, some of these interpreters for years.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of people right now my favorite news station, Fox News, allowing people on like Stephen Miller, who has a bee in his bonnet about immigrants from anywhere, saying we shouldn't take these people. We shouldn't take these people, even the interpreters. So it has not been easy to get into the United States for quite some time.
Yeah, and I think we should take these. I think we should take the people that help us, like take immigrants. I think we should take them in. But it's a plan that, you know, we've known about for a year. And now, you know, this administration is stuck with following through on it.
Yeah.
It's a horrible situation, but I just can't see the especially the Americans that are there that should have been out. Why now our militaries are going in to go get them and pull them out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a suicide mission. It's horrible.
James, thank you very much for the call. Let's hope that this is the last of these attacks, and let's hope. I mean, I think everybody's got a lump in their throat worrying about the rest of these military men and women getting out of that airport. I mean, it's just frightening.
Yeah, so nerve-wracking the next 4 days.
Yeah,
as the tension builds and builds and builds.
Mel from Rosendale, thank you for calling.
Hi, Marjorie. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Mel.
This is Mel Arredondo.
Oh, Mel Arredondo. Thank you for calling, Mel. You lost your son in this long 20-year endeavor.
No, he died in Iraq.
In Iraq.
And as a matter of fact, his 17th anniversary was Wednesday, which I got through just fine. And then this happens on Thursday. It was just so one of the things that happened for me personally, Marjorie, is that I kept on thinking about when we got informed of when Alex came and all the family members of the Marines and the Navy corpsmen. I just imagining the knock on the door that kept on playing through my head all day. I've been online with a lot of other Gold Star families from here in Massachusetts and across the country, and so have a lot of them feel the exact same way. It's a club no one wants to join.
No.
No one wants the Gold Star family distinction, you know, and I'm not making light of it. It's something that is a saying that we tend to say. The situation in Afghanistan, first of all, Alex was prepared for Afghanistan. Okay. He was not trained for the desert.
Yeah.
He was trained for scaling mountains and he was very good at it and helping his team to be in that sort of environment. So I always remember that because he was truly a leader in that. But I think about, of course, the Afghans, but also how this 20-year war quagmire. I really feel that this country led that effort. 20 years. It is called the longest war, and it was called the longest war 10 years ago. I remember going to listen to different military people, Andrew Basevich, who you know, talking about how this is already called the longest war 10 years ago. Okay? And I just think to myself, how could we have gotten out any better? To me, that's not the question. The question is, why did we have to lose so many there? How many Afghans have died there? The children, the young girls who want to go to school, okay? Yes, the schools are there, but there are many who suffered and died for expressing that new freedom.
Mel, what year did your son die?
2004.
Yeah, I just want to mention to people who may not know, Mel and Carlos Arredondo, your husband was an early crusader against this war. He was very courageous in his outspokenness about this war. You both have done wonderful work with the flags, with those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of flags that are on Boston Common.
Yeah.
Carlos, as people may know.
Great organization.
Yeah.
Yeah, Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, a great organization that has supported so many.
And your husband was there on the day of the marathon bombing, coincidentally, at the finish line and famous photo. You both were. And a famous photograph of Carlos. Tell us about that photograph of your husband.
Well, Carlos was trained in the Red Cross and also knew first aid, and we always kept up with our CPR and first aid. Going back to when he was a kid in Costa Rica, that's how long it went. And so when the bombs went off, he ran towards the tragedy unfolding at the finish line because we were right across the street. And he helped bring the fences down along with the other first responders in order to get to those who were injured or dead or dying.
And came down the street,
right?
He got
to Jeff Bowman.
Yes.
Huh? He got Jeff Bowman. Another angel came who brought a wheelchair, and another angel came, another paramedic. They ran him to the first ambulance that got to BMC, to my understanding, first. He was the first one to get there. And unfortunately, he did lose his legs. Jeff lived and continues to live. I don't know if you know this. He's going to be a lawyer. He's in his second year.
Oh, I did not. I did not know that,
yeah.
But he was a wonderful man. Mel, thank you so much for calling as a Gold Star, a family member, and thank you so much for what you and Carlos have done for the veterans of these two long wars and also for their families. You're both pretty heroic to me,
Mel.
Thank
you for this. Thank you for letting people talk about this. It's really in a lot of people's mind and hearts.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mel. Anyway, famous photographs
of course,
Carlos
absolutely.
At the marathon bombing. I think we are out of time. We can squeeze in one quick call.
Let's quickly go to Laura in Webster. Hi, Laura. We just have about 30 seconds left.
Hi. Thanks. Great show. I wanted to say that I think our dismay over not having certain goals met, like women's rights and infrastructure, is accepting the fact that it was all profit-driven. I think we need to really take a long, hard look at who decides where we go to so-called spring democracy, because I think it was, you know, a lot of money was made in Afghanistan that's not being talked about.
Laura, we are out of time, but that's a great point.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for that call. This was great for certain corporations in America, and we should never forget that, who became millionaires while we were over there.
And obviously fueled so much of the corruption within the Afghan government that also has affected this greatly. Well, thank you all for your calls today. We appreciate it. By coming up, we're talking to a doctor about navigating a truly split-screen existence, as both an ICU physician and a producer of a TV hospital drama. That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, last year to mark Beethoven's 250th birthday, conductor Marin Alsop created the Global Ode to Joy Project, inviting esteemed writers to update Friedrich Schiller's accompanying poem. One of those writers is the former poet laureate of the United States, Tracy K. Smith, whose version of the symphony will be performed for free tonight at the Hatchell by the Handel and Haydn Society. Marin Alsop and Tracy K. Smith join us to discuss.
I'm Jared Bowen, and for Jim Browdy, it's Friday, which means GBH's Callie Crossley is back. She'll be weighing in on hypocrisy in cable news. Some outlets have been allowing hosts to fuel vaccine skepticism and COVID conspiracy outrage for months, all while quietly enforcing safety protocols when the cameras are off. Then the founders of Boston Uncornered will tell us all about their new photography project featuring the Boston mayoral candidates, on view now in the Seaport District. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is on vacation. Jared Bowen, Executive Arts Editor here at GBH, is filling in. Hello again.
Hello again, Marjorie.
Jared. Okay. In life, particularly amid a pandemic, who does not want to have the opportunity to do a do-over, to go back in time and make things right? The world of television production, when things go wrong, the industry lingo goes, we can fix that in post. It's a phrase that has a lot of resonance for Dr. Daniela Lamas. She's a pulmonary and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and, in her spare time, a co-producer on the TV medical drama The Resonant. In her latest piece for the New York Times, she writes about how the grim realities of being a physician aren't always the ones that should or need to make it onto the small screen. She's either with us or she's about to be with us.
She's about to be with us. Joining momentarily, we're
joining told. Momentarily is Daniela Lamas, and we're really anxious to talk to her. But you know something? While we're waiting for her, Jim and I interviewed her before, and she's done all this research about people in ICU care in hospitals, the trauma that they experience getting out of the ICU, assuming they survive, and a lot of them tragically don't survive, but how they have nightmares about what went on there. They don't remember. They like to come back and take tours through the ICU so they can try to recollect their time in the ICU. It's amazing. It's groundbreaking.
I'm so eager to talk to her about this because, yeah, I was reading some of this and I found it absolutely fascinating, especially the people who want to go back and really understand what they went through. Also very eager to talk to her about is she joining us now? Is that what we're hearing from our producers about the television shows? And are they as accurate as they seem to be with all of that rushing around on the sets and the beeping and the tests? And it seems like they are.
Well, one of her theses is that TV can teach us a lot about medicine because we have a lot of misinformation about medicine. And the other thing that we're going to talk to her about, too, is the idea of these miracles that occasionally happen. And I'm not going to tell you because she's here
herself.
We can
ask now.
And she can tell us. Okay, you were late, doctor, but we're glad we've got you. Better late than never, right?
yes, I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us again. We were just talking about what Jim and I talked to you before about your work with people getting out of ICUs. But if we have time, we'll get to that, too. We already talked about that. We did want to talk about your kind of moonlighting job in you're there at the hospital and then you're helping a production of a TV show. So tell us about that and what you've learned about doing both.
Yes. Yeah, so I've long been an avid viewer of medical television dramas, which is, I think, perhaps a slightly unusual characteristic for a physician. Often people find them insufferable because of medical inaccuracy, but I love them. And I'm interested in them, not just for the drama, but you know, I'm interested broadly in how medicine is portrayed to the public. And so, you know, for those two reasons, I found myself drawn to ER. I've seen all of those episodes multiple times, and even all of the current ones, including Grey's Anatomy. You know, I've watched all of them.
I love them. I think they're great.
All right. Well, then I'm not alone. Yes. And what is particularly compelling to me is that these are ways to give medical information to millions of people through drama. And so the opportunity to actually be a part of the generation of these plots and to be behind the scenes writing the medicine and the story for the show I work on, which is The Resident, was just a fantastic opportunity, one I pursued for quite some time. And was thrilled to be able to do.
Well, let me ask you, so I won't ask you about the legitimacy of the romances and the affairs you see on Grey's Anatomy.
Well, we love those too, don't we?
Well, we do. Some of them, I can tell you, are probably a little far-fetched. But as you were looking at these shows, were you finding accuracy or did you want to leap through the screen and correct them on the spot?
I think both things are true. I think that there are... there's a range of shows that prioritize accuracy, medical accuracy, a little bit more than, the soap for the characters. That being said, I think what I find particularly interesting, and yes, there are definitely moments where, watching one has to think to oneself, that wouldn't happen that way. But then the follow-up question, which is one that I've learned more recently after, having to think about how to put together plot lines myself, I think the follow-up question is, does that matter? Does it matter if we show a lab test coming back more quickly than it does in real life? Probably not. If we all showed people waiting and continuing to refresh their computers for lab tests, nobody would watch. But does it matter if we show that the outcome of the surgery is far better than it could ever be in real life? Is that potentially misleading? And I think the answer is yes. So there's inaccuracies, and then there are inaccuracies in sort of thinking about what is important to show in an accurate way, I think is an interesting conversation.
Well, you know, I thought one of your points, which was so fascinating, particularly in this time when we have all this disinformation, misinformation, bad information about vaccines and COVID and stuff, was how a television show that I guess you had a heart patient there that, you know, what did he tell you? Didn't want you to do the examination or not finish until you finished watching his show.
Yes. Whatever.
Yeah. I think you're totally right that television drama could do a lot to help us. I mean, what'd you say about this?
I definitely think so. You know, I definitely think so. You know, thinking in the setting of this essay, which just reflected broader thoughts I've had about sort of this balance between escapism and reality, that in the world where we are right now, in this country where information, where fact, objective fact has become politicized and fiction is being spread around purporting to be fact, that TV drama, which is inherently less political, it appeals to people across all political leanings, that is a way to get across information that perhaps the more accurate newscast or even documentaries that might only appeal to a segment of the population, they might not be able to do as effectively.
Dr. Lamas, I'm hearing you talk. I'm thinking of an equivalent conversation, perhaps an equivalent conversation I've had over the years with people in the criminal justice system who talk about the CSI effect.
Oh, yes.
And how jurors who are well-steeped in criminal justice, you know, with their years of education from watching all of these dramas, expect certain things in trials. They expect certain elements of concrete evidence. I'm wondering how much of that is, you know, the equivalency, how much it's filtered into the medical world, too, where you have patients coming to you who believe they know how something should be conducted, or they believe they know their own diagnosis based on what they've seen on fictional television shows.
Yes, I think, you know, clear specifics of people seeing something on shows, people have brought up to me that they've seen potential diagnoses and they wonder about them. That even if they don't say it explicitly, I think what you're talking about, that sort of CSI effect, is important to think about. You know, there was a study some years back looking at the outcome of codes on television. A group of researchers actually watched, I think, all of the seasons of ER and published in the New England Journal of Medicine this sort of original research where they looked at the codes on ER and compared them to codes in real life and found, unsurprisingly, that people on television who have cardiac arrest in the hospital do far better than real life have cardiac arrest in the hospital. And that matters. You know, I think if we were to show all codes as sort of miserable, we might lose people, but who would view and might get information otherwise. But I think that those sorts of portrayals of unrealistic outcomes do matter. And so I think that there is a danger there that in the pursuit of drama, we give people this idea of medicine as being more successful or more powerful to right, you know, sort of really devastating illness than it actually is. And even if they don't say it explicitly, I think that is there in people's heads. And so that's something that we need to think about.
Well, I have a guy that was on House that could diagnose some disease that only three people had in 1890 in some, you know, far-flung area of Africa or Dakar, Senegal or something like that. I thought he was a little bit unrealistic, doctor. But anyway, we're talking to Dr. Danielle Lamas. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times. She's also a pulmonary and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Let me tell you, doctor, as someone who used to write for a living, it's really annoying to me that you can be such a good physician and such a good writer. It really gets under my craw a little bit.
It's the first thing she said this morning, by the way,
yeah,
Dr. Lamas.
Really, no, you're beautiful. You're a beautiful writer. Can we talk a little bit, though? You wrote a lot early on about COVID. And one of the pieces you wrote was about, back to the Times, was about dreading the winter. This was from a year ago. And here we are again. We have our vaccine and we have several vaccines, but I think there's a lot of dread among the general public about what this winter is going to mean for us in 2021. What do you think?
Yes, I think it's so hard. I think one of the things that COVID has taught us is that looking ahead and thinking and predicting how things will be, we're so often wrong. You know, I personally, while we all sort of worried about vaccine hesitancy, I wouldn't have expected the hospitals, my father's a physician in Miami, the hospital where he works, to be as full of unvaccinated COVID patients right now than it is. That being said, I think looking ahead toward the winter, I think that whatever will come to pass is still in our control. And I think that there's so much obviously out of our control, but depending on how many people sort of see what's going on around them and decide to get vaccinated, that can change that outcome. If that doesn't change, then I think that there is obviously the possibility for continued, largely unnecessary death and suffering. But I can remain hopeful that that will change.
Doctor, I had one more question about the television side, and it actually relates to mm-hmm. what you were just talking about, that these shows obviously want to create drama and compelling stories that really draw people in. But what's some of the resistance you found knowing what you might be facing, what you just talked about, so the grim realities, for lack of a better term, the drama you might be facing this winter? What's the resistance that you face when you bring some of those stories to the producers, and how much they actually are willing to reflect given what you experience?
You know, I think what we see in the intensive care unit, particularly at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where we're affiliated with Dana-Farber, there is so much sadness. And in those moments of sadness, there's also great grace and beauty and love, but there is a lot of sadness. And I think that it is hard for people to view multiple stories that leave them devastated, that leave them sad. People don't largely turn on the television for that. And so I think that in order to try to put across any amount of education or information, the producers, the people who I've worked with as this show, have taught me that this isn't a documentary, that we can reflect some of the reality of the hospital, some of the sadness and grace in the setting of terminal illness, but that we also have to give people hope for them to continue to watch. And I feel that. I can understand that. And so I think that is a balance that I'm always trying to navigate, but one that I am hopeful that we come out on the side of giving people a reason to keep watching, but also leaving them with something that's real as well.
You know, Doctor, I've thought many times during this whole pandemic that what we see of patients in the hospital is largely these very clinical pictures of people in bed with a ventilator, all these machines they're attached to. But we don't see what I read about, which is people gasping for breath and waiting to get attended to, and mm-hmm. the suffering that goes along with COVID. And I know that they are obviously, who wants to have one of their loved ones, you know, in shown on any kind of video suffering. On the other hand, I've often thought if we saw that, maybe so many of us wouldn't be so cavalier and say, oh, well, you know, I'm young and healthy. If I get this, not a big deal. Can you talk a little bit, because I know you were very involved with COVID patients right mm-hmm. from the start. It is a big deal to be gasping for breath. That's yes. horrible.
Yes. You know, I think what you're asking is really interesting. And I think one aspect of that is the question of what it is that what are the levers that we can pull to change behavior? And I wonder about fear as fear of a potential outcome as behavior, as a reason for behavior change. I know, you know, sort of with cigarette smoking, having those pictures on a package of cigarettes to make meaningful change. In the setting of COVID, I wonder, you know, so much of the narrative is, well, I know it could be horrible, but it won't be me. That being said, I do think that showing some of how it can be, and also explaining to people that this is not just life or death, that there is a wide range of outcomes, even for those who survive, that are undesirable, I think is extraordinarily important. You know, when we were putting together the episodes of our show that were surrounding COVID, and we had one that was sort of specific to the pandemic, we really did make an effort, and you know, within the limitations of what's possible for a medical TV drama, we did make an effort to show that type of suffering that you're describing, and the fear of somebody being intubated who might not wake up again. And so to try to bring people into that moment, did it change behavior? hard to say, obviously. But I think what you're saying is important, that there are things that are, it is important to not gloss over.
I'm wondering about how you feel about going into the fall. I think we're all hoping that we won't see the cases here in this region that we're in, the stories and the visuals that we're seeing all across the South, where, again, they're setting up tents outside and in garages just to accommodate the number of patients. And I ask you that because I had the opportunity through the arts, actually, to speak with some emergency department workers from Brigham and Women's Hospital, where you are, who are working with a songwriter to basically process the year that was in song. And it was kind of like therapy. They definitely have experienced PTSD, I think they would admit, as they come out of this and they recognize what has happened to them. Everything from fearing going out in public in their scrubs for how people were afraid of them, to having horrific migraines at the end of the day for working 14-hour shifts with no water because they couldn't take their masks down. So how do you continue on, and how do you find your colleagues are continuing on after such an exhausting, grueling period already?
I think it's a sort of hard, I'm thinking how to come at that answer, other than the fact that, you know, one continues on and tries to remain empathic to the patients that we see. You know, I think it helps that we have not yet seen, and perhaps will not see, the sort of resurgence of a large number of COVID patients. But I think we're already seeing the sequela of that, even not through COVID. You know, I was just in the ICU for a relatively brief stretch and was getting repeated calls from our hospital's transfer center trying to get patients from Maine, from other states, transferred down to our hospital because there were literally no ICU beds available at any of the hospitals closer to them. And there were patients waiting for days, waiting. One patient who we cared for waited for days to start receiving chemotherapy for a new diagnosis of cancer because the hospital that she was at wasn't able to supply that. Another patient who we were ultimately unable to take was having a large bleed in an ER where there was nobody who could intervene on it. And so, you know, those stories and this feeling of knowing that sort of everyone is intertwined and that we're responsible for people who are beyond the number of beds that are in our hospital, I think that sort of gives you chills of thinking of all of these people who are suffering in different ways, sort of as a ripple effect of decisions that were made by people to not get vaccinated, who then got sick. That was sort of a long answer to your question that didn't quite answer it. But I guess what I'm saying is that I am worried not just about the patients that we see with COVID, but about all of those after effects. And that's sort of real. And I'm wondering how we can feel like we make real difference, even if these are patients that we can't ultimately treat because we don't have enough beds.
And doctor, in layman's terms, when you say we don't have enough ICU beds, you touched on it there with the person with the mm-hmm. bleed and the person with the chemo. But, you know, from what does that generally mean in terms of what you cannot do to help someone?
Right. So we talk about beds. I think that's a really good point. We talk about beds and it sounds like I'm talking about a physical bed because that's what I said. But really, we're talking not just about a bed. You know, we've seen in COVID, people can make beds in a cafeteria, though, of course, we never had to do that. But we're talking about staffing. We're talking about the nurse who can be at the bedside. We're talking about the respiratory therapist. Really, people are a much more limited resource than actual beds. I know we all feared ventilator shortages, but people were the resource that were limited more than that. And so really, it's a question, and it's a question of hospitals and their abilities to flex up, to make more beds. When do they decide to do that? And by that, I mean, make sure there are more people. And sort of when do they decide to do that? If their own hospital is not inundated, but we know that other hospitals are, sort of what is that broader responsibility? I don't know the answers to those questions, but I think that they are interesting and important and ones that we'll likely have to answer.
So in other words, people that would not get that level of expertise that they might need if they had a particularly complex problem mm-hmm. because those people aren't there at that hospital.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a very big deal. I'm glad I'm in Boston.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. The ER that you end up in now might be the hospital that you stay in because this idea, well, they could just transfer you into a bigger center, it's likely not going to be as possible as it would have been.
Dr. Lamas, at the outset of this segment, Marjorie was talking about something that you had written about before and talked about on the show. I didn't have the benefit of hearing
That's
that,
right.
So I'm assuming some of our audience didn't either. But I find this fascinating. And this is the work that you've done in regard to life after the ICU. Again, I think it's relevant in this time because of thinking of the COVID long haulers and some of the experiences that they are realizing, thinking that they have come out of COVID, but realize that those situations are with them. And it sounds not unlike what patients coming out of the ICU might experience.
Very much so. So exactly. Even prior to COVID, I had become interested in the experience of people who survive intensive care and this sort of breadth of experience that exists between surviving and fully recovering. And this idea and sort of knowledge that there are people who maybe have physical impairments as a result, that's more obvious, but also psychological issues, post-traumatic stress, as you mentioned, among doctors as well, but that can afflict patients who've been through a critical illness, which is a huge trauma, cognitive issues from a combination, not just people of strokes or something like that, but even if the brain was not clearly impacted, cognitive issues from a combination of being sick and medications that we give. And so I was interested in that. We started a clinic at the Brigham where we saw these patients and screened them for these issues and then sent them to appropriate referrals. And I think at that point, pre-COVID, there wasn't as much of the public understanding that surviving a catastrophic illness is not the same as recovering. And COVID has really brought that to the fore of people who have survived, but are suffering sort of a sequence of sequelae and need really sort of strong and robust support for that.
You know, Doctor, the other thing that you wrote about early on was about the period in which people could not visit their very sick and sometimes dying loved ones in the hospital. You talked about a young woman that went to see her parents. Both of them apparently got COVID and they were in separate rooms, her mother and her father, very, very sick. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes.
I assume that's not true anymore. I hope it's not true anymore, but tell us both.
Yes. So that really has been one of the, I think, less anticipated, but most powerful consequences of this disease and of the fact that we were all trying to avoid this infectious disease is the idea that, you know, visitor restrictions came and then they stayed. And they stayed much longer than any of us anticipated because initially the need for them stayed longer. And then I think that there was a fear and a lingering. And while currently it is much easier to get visitors into the hospital than it was clearly during those early surges, and even for more than a year after, it's still not back to how it was. There is still this pause in the intensive care unit when we say we want a visitor to come. Well, what precautions are they on? How many people? When people are dying in the intensive care unit, depending on who is on and the willingness of people to bend a rule, there's still the rule that we have two at a time entering the room. And so it's still not back to how it was before COVID, where we had family members with us on rounds. They were really an integral part of the ICU. It's still different. It's definitely different.
One last thing for me, Doctor, since you are on the radio with us and we'd like to thank lots of listeners. I hope we have lots of listeners. That's what they tell us anyway.
Me too.
I wouldn't still be here, I guess, if we didn't have a good audience. But in any case, you are a physician at the Brigham. You have seen and treated patients with COVID. You've seen what this means. To those listeners out there who are still thinking, well, you know, the mask thing is kind of a pain in the neck, and I'm not really sure I need to wear one, and I'm not sure my kids need to wear one in school, and I'm not even sure if I should get vaccinated. What would you say to those people? Because some of them are probably listening.
Yeah, I would say, I'll tackle the vaccine thing first. I would say that this is clearly, there have been so many people now who have gotten vaccinated, and everything we are seeing in the hospital is that vaccines are safe and that not getting vaccinated, even if you are young, even if you are healthy, even if you say, I'll be okay, really might not be. And if you get vaccinated, you will be. It's really, there are so few things, as we were saying earlier, there are so few things that we can really control. And our risk of getting critically ill from this virus is one of them. It's really amazing. It is an amazing feat of science that happened. And it's amazing that we can get it. It's now widely available. And so just encourage people to really think about their fears and objections and talk to people they trust, because getting vaccinated is, it's actually an immense, an amazing gift. And you can really change both your own outcome and the outcome of those around you who you love. And in terms of masks, look, I get it. I mean, I too find masks annoying. We wear them in the hospital constantly. Do I wish we didn't have to? Yes. But would I also feel just horrible if I, as a vaccinated person, ended up getting somebody else sick who didn't have the ability, maybe they had an impaired immune system, didn't have the ability to protect themselves? Yeah, I'd feel awful. So it's definitely worth wearing a mask.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Lamas, and thank you for your great pieces in the New York Times. They're really great. And for your TV show.
Yes.
Multimedia person.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope we can see you again
doing
in person sometimes, Doctor.
I would love to. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you
so much. Dr. Daniela Lamas is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, a pulmonary and critical care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a co-producer on the TV medical drama The Resident. Again, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Coming up, how is social media dealing with the Taliban takeover? Tech writer Andy Anatko joins us for that conversation and other tech lines. He's here, so keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jad Bowen is in for Jim Browdy, and I sound like Wolf Blitzer on CNN. We have some breaking news. We might actually have something positive to say about Facebook today. Facebook is adopting new security measures to protect Afghans from the Taliban, who could be using Facebook to endanger Afghans by mining their quote-unquote friends lists and other sensitive information. Our tech writer Andy Anatko joins us to talk about how social media is responding to the Taliban takeover, among other tech headlines. You can find Andy's work at anatko.com. I always spell it I-H-N-A-T-K-O, anatko.com. Or you can follow him at Anatko. Andy, great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So tell us about Facebook and the Taliban. What elaborate. What's going on?
Yeah, this has created a lot of problems for a lot of social media companies. Number one, the Taliban has been banned from Facebook, from YouTube, from Twitter, from all these different organizations, mostly because of how they have been distributing content, and also because certain U.S. agencies have designated them as a terrorist group, and that basically makes them bannable from the entire platform. Facebook, as a matter of fact, explicitly a couple of weeks ago reiterated that they, as far as they're concerned, as an official group, they are still banned, even though they are now the ruling power in Afghanistan. But it goes much farther than that, because the Taliban apparently has been exploiting Facebook and other social media accounts to look for people who are living in Afghanistan who might have Western influences, meaning people who on their friends list, they have people from the West, or even people who appear not to be explicitly friends of the Taliban and Taliban's agencies. So as a result, they've taken some unusual steps. Facebook has created a new set of rules for users in Afghanistan. Friends lists that are normally public are now private. They've also installed what amounts to a panic switch on those accounts, where if a user in Afghanistan wants to immediately shut down their account and take it offline, they can do it in basically one or two steps instead of having to go through are you sure? What have we done as Facebook? We could improve to make you – no, they appreciate that this is a life or death situation, so they've made that kind of change. Other organizations are trying to do their best. Twitter, for instance, is in another unusual situation because it's a public resource. You don't have to be a member of Twitter to read stuff that's been posted on it. This stuff gets archived by, for instance, the Internet Archive, archive.org. And so it doesn't matter if a user pulls down a certain tweet that is pro-West, that could be turned up at archive.org. So they're actually having negotiations with that site, with archive.org, saying, look, if we have a user that's deactivated their account and they're Afghanistan users, can you please make this information not searchable in the archives? Because once again, it is a life or death sort of situation unexpectedly.
Here, Andy, I'm thinking, remember the Arab Spring, so much of that so much of the information that we had there came through social media, as we've seen in other uprisings. I'm not sure I've seen that so much, and maybe I just haven't paid close enough attention over the last week in Afghanistan. How prevalent is social media at this moment?
It's mostly back channel. Mostly it appears that people are relying on secure communications such as WhatsApp. However, it also appears that the Taliban is attempting to sort of break the security of pretty much any platform they can find. As I said, it becomes a very, very tricky situation if, let's say, that they manage to hold control of this country and they become, as a matter of fact, the ruling party, the ruling organization. Do they have the ability to say, hey, look, I don't care if you don't like our like us or not. We are officially the rulers of this entire country, have been for the past 5 years. You are going to unblock our accounts. You are going to allow us, if we pass a law saying that we need to be able to have direct access to all private communications within our country, you are going to do that because, again, we are the ruling party. We are the authority inside this country. Then what does Twitter do? What does Facebook do? The good news is that, you know, the diplomatic immunity does not necessarily affect work as a principle when it comes to social media companies. We found out that, you know, they could even ban the president of the United States if the president simply continues to break Twitter policy. So they might be able to continue to protect its users, but suffice to say that in a dorm room in Harvard University, this was not something that the creators of Facebook were thinking of, that they're going to have to be protecting the users of the service in this way right now.
You know, Andy, does the fact that Twitter and Facebook can do this, should that make us suspicious that they can do other things if they want to, that they claim they can't, in terms of getting rid of lies and misinformation on their sites?
I'm not ready to go there just yet, because they do have so much power, but the thing is, they also are aware of the repercussions of their existence and the role that they didn't ask for in the world right now. And so when it comes to policy changes that don't affect their bottom line, they do, even Facebook, seem to be very aware that there are things they could and should be doing, and they're trying their very best. And I think that I don't know how I would legislate or require Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or whatever to do or not do certain things under a situation like this. There are policies that you just have to put into place, find out where the weaknesses are, then patch them as they go. You're not going to find a magic wand against this.
So, Andy, I guess maybe the Wolf Blitzer breaking news, good news,
continues
yes, even though we don't have the music that always sweeps in with whenever Wolf Blitzer has one of those big announcements.
Does Wolf Blitzer smile much or laugh much? I don't think so.
I don't think there's a lot of reason to for his breaking news.
They did a big thing on him on Saturday Night Live, Wolf Blitzer takeoff. And the other thing is, I'm sorry, Andy, just want to say, who names a kid Wolf Blitzer? I mean, really?
Well, you know, anyway, thank you for that little sideline. You know, nobody had the name Jared when I was growing up. That seemed like such an abnormal name, so I guess I embrace
Jared's
it.
Jared's a wonderful name, actually.
And now quite prolific, so I'm no longer singular. But Andy, the other good news might be, depending on how you look at it, a victory for people who were very concerned about how controlling Apple was with the apps. Tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, this news just broke this morning. Apple has been facing a bunch of different lawsuits on a bunch of different fronts on how it runs its app store. The biggest one has been the games developer Epic Games. They make Fortnite. They're still deeply, deeply mired in this huge, never-ending lawsuit where Epic Games, on behalf of other developers, is saying that, look, Apple should not be able to require that the only place people can get their apps for their iPhone from are from the Apple App Store. If we decide that as a company that we don't want to pay the 30% or 15% or whatever commission fee, or we don't like the terms that Apple is offering, we should be able to offer our apps to this platform on our own. And that's still going on, still raging on. However, showing that Apple and Google, I think they know that they don't have a very strong hand to play in these lawsuits, particularly not against regulators worldwide that are attacking them. So Apple decided to settle one of these class action suits that's a separate short one. And they didn't give up a whole lot. But once again, the fact that they decided to settle and not just battle this out indicates that they are aware that they're going to have to change their game. Really, all they've agreed to do is that developers who put apps on the App Store, they're no longer muzzled against informing users that there are alternative payment methods for their services available. They used to be under an enormous gag rule saying that you can't tell anybody that you can buy if you're subscribing to a podcast, subscribing to or buying books or whatever. You can't tell anybody that you can, if you go to and use our service on our website, you can do the same thing and avoid paying Apple. You're not allowed to tell anybody about that. That's a stupid rule, and that's been eliminated. They also announced a couple of years ago in, quote, in response to COVID, unquote, absolutely had nothing to do with the Epic lawsuit, that they would temporarily lower their 30% app commission to 15% for small developers, again, to help them get through this COVID crisis. And according to this settlement, that's going to be at least in place for the next 3 years. They've also done a couple other things. Most of the biggest one, as far as I'm concerned, is they've agreed to commit to a transparency report every year on the number of apps that it rejects that are submitted to the store, the number of apps that are removed, and why, data on search results. It was one of the biggest problems was that the App Store is a completely closed box. And I have friends who are app developers. Some of them make some of the most popular apps that are available to the iPhone and to the Mac. And the huge frustration is that for 3 years in a row, as they issue app updates, okay, well, that's fine. And then suddenly it's not fine, and Apple won't tell them why their update got rejected. And all the reasons get given the runaround, and it's frustrating because all their entire factory, so to speak, gets ground to a halt as they try to solve problems that Apple won't tell them that they actually have. It really is like some sort of a game. So that will help out. But once again, it's not as big as, okay, we will allow people to sell apps outside of the App Store and install apps that we didn't approve. But once again, it is a demonstration that they know that they're going to have to change all of this stuff in order to continue to survive in this current environment.
And at the same time, what's happening with South Korea that kind of puts – is it Apple almost going against itself or precedent anyway? I'm trying to follow this one.
It's a problem for the government, okay, because South Korea has introduced its own App Store bill that is now like one more vote and one presidential signature away from becoming law that actually is very, very meaningful. It would affect Apple and Google and basically say that any independent developer has the ability to use their own payment processors. They don't have to use the Google system. They don't have to use the Apple system. And it would also prevent Google and Apple from blocking an app from appearing on a competing app store. Those two are very, very big things. It's not the whole enchilada, but those are significant things that Apple and Google have been fighting tooth and nail over for the past 2 or 3 years. And again, one more Senate vote, one more presidential signature, and that becomes law in South Korea. These are things that the United States government have been asking for. As a matter of fact, just a couple of weeks ago, two Democratic senators plus a Republican teamed up to introduce a new bill that would enact almost the exact same rules, and they would be in application here in the United States. However, because the law and diplomacy are both hysterically funny, Google and Apple, through a trade group, are trying to make the case to the United States government that, hey, you know, this is going to really affect American industry business in South Korea, and you're supposed to, like, defend American business overseas. I read on the business on the trading card that you gave me when we decided to become an American business, and we're wondering if this doesn't violate a trade agreement for them to pass this law, and if it is, maybe you could go to South Korea and yell at them and tell them to not, like, keep honking down our snorkel like this, because we want to be able to do exactly what we want to do. So that you see how in one office in Washington, you have a group of people that's trying to get Apple and Google to give up anti-competitive behavior. Across the hall, there's another office that is resigned to saying, okay, we will send a memo. For the record, DC has not made an official position on this. It looks like they're just trying to indicates that perhaps they have a case here that maybe this is not a good thing for American industry, but they have not made one step towards a diplomatic overture towards South Korea saying you better not do this, or you'd better carve out an exception for Google and Apple because you are in violation of X, Y, and Z.
Well, you also point out, Andy, that this Epic Games suit has resulted in Apple and Google having to hand over a bunch of internal data. and it doesn't look good, particularly good. It doesn't look good, particularly for Google. So what's that about?
Yeah, this is why I love these lawsuits, because that's the only time that you find out. Because I'm serious, it's the only time you learn anything that's substantive about these big companies that normally don't have to say anything to anybody. But a whole new trove of the documents, internal documents, got handed over or made public last week. And Google particularly looks very, very bad, because it revealed internal analysis that Google's finance department did when Epic first filed this suit. And they wanted to answer the question for themselves. Well, what if we did allow – what if Epic did win this suit, or what if we gave them the permission to sell apps outside of the Google Play Store? What would the financial hit be? And the finance department came back with a number of anywhere between $350 million to $1.5 billion up until 2022. They also extrapolated this and say, well, what if there is legal precedent that's been established and everybody gets in on the game? Let's say that Samsung decides to create its own Samsung app store for Android. Amazon decides to extend its own Amazon app store for all Android devices. In that case, they put the figure as high as $6 billion up until 2023. So that A establishes that they're very, very, very well motivated, despite their protest that, oh, but we're very concerned about our users' experience and the security of the we won't allow the security of our devices to be compromised. Yeah, there's 6 billion other reasons why they want this thing in place. It also revealed that they started making these secret deals with app developers, saying, if we give you a lot of money, will you agree never to put your app make your app available on another app store? Great. They were also making deals exclusively with phone makers, the hardware makers, saying that if we give you a much bigger cut of the revenue that's generated by Google search on your device, will you agree to make the Google Play Store the default pre-installed app store on your device, and agree not to put another app store by default on the device, where, you know, people could install them later on, but out of the box, you wouldn't have like the Samsung app store, you wouldn't have the Amazon app store. This all, again, makes it very, very bad for Google to make the case that, no, we just want the best for our users. We don't feel vulnerable in any way, shape, or form by these petitions. So, yeah, that's pretty bad.
Buried in there was your audition for Hamilton to play King George. Is that what I was hearing in there?
Yeah, Andy, that's right.
You'll be back soon. You'll remember you belong. I own a crown. I do own my own crown.
I can't sing, but that was one of my favorite moments in Hamilton.
I heard that Andy Anako can sing. I just realized that.
You'll be, that's right. That's right. They don't,
I'm more
know.
Of a singer dancer. I don't want to say I'm a dancer, too. So, mostly a singer, but I can. I'm a good mover, is what the auditioner said.
What was the King George line? He said he's going to kill all your family and friends to prove his love. Wasn't that what he said?
Kill all your friends and family to remind you of my love.
La 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 la. That's pretty good, or pretty bad, I suppose.
Or pretty bad, yeah.
Okay, so Andy Nutko, you have 3 minutes to tell us why you're so mad and disgusted and think Elon Musk at Tesla is full of garbage. Take it away.
Right at the moment, we all thought that self-driving cars were imminent.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, so last week was Tesla's AI Day, which is sort of like their State of the Union. They do these sort of State of the Union several times a year on different parts of their research, mostly to attract researchers to come work for Tesla and make their products better. And part of it was mostly Elon Musk on stage speaking mostly off the cuff. There was definitely an agenda, but it's not as though everything was written out. But he admitted that the full self-driving software that just got released, I think he said, quote, it is, quote, not great, mentioning all the problems that they're having with it. I won't go outside of what he said. Mostly everything that he was talking about reminds me that of all the companies that are putting tens of billions of dollars into self-driving technology, Tesla is doing it in the least responsible way. They are doing it in a way that suggests that they think that their unique way of developing this is right, and literally every other researcher is doing it the wrong way. He admitted that one of the reasons why their software is not great is because of one of the choices they made, whereas Intel and Google, Waymo, and these others, mostly what they're doing is they're doing very, very limited testing and training of the software in specific geographical areas, like in Phoenix, 100 square miles, that's it, because they feel as though they need to train this AI on this one location. Tesla had decided that, oh, no, we can write one piece of software that does everything. It does the highway. It does local streets. It'll do Boston downtown at rush hour. It will do Nebraska any time of the day or night. And so he admits that this is one of the reasons why their software for full self-driving, as opposed to just the assistive technologies, isn't particularly good at this time. But the good news is that you could be sharing a road with people using the software any time of the day or night, because they don't seem to follow the rules that have been set by most states about allowing full self-driving software active on any cars. But the thing that really got up my nose was, so he, at one point she reveals a new product that he claims they're working on, the Tesla Bot.
Yes.
A robot.
Yes.
Built by Tesla, powered by Tesla artificial intelligence. And it really, I had to like rewind it like three times to make sure that I was getting angry for the right reasons. Because so many reasons. I'll try to be efficient here and say that one of them is that it is off the scale snake oil. Even by Elon Musk standards, you cannot, it will peg the needle at red, that there is no way in holy heck that they actually plan to make this or will build this. I won't believe it until it's on a shrink wrap peg at Best Buy. I have no belief whatsoever this is a serious product. I mean, you talk about this endomorphic, this like slight, like skeleton like little robot that they've envisioned with capabilities that are far beyond anything that is even predicted for the next 5 or 10 years. It's nonsense. Mostly though, that A, it's tech bro thinking, where like we collectively as a society, we have a limited number of resources and bandwidth to develop stuff. But yes, we're a San Francisco-based tech bro. Let's build something totally useless that's kind of cool, that won't solve any real problems for anybody. That's how we should be using our time on this earth. But number one on the bullet, number one on the list, is this quote, a direct quote. So why are they building a robot? He claims, and this is a quote, "I think essentially in the future, physical work will be a choice. If you want to do it, you can." And my God, that's where I heard the disconnection of Elon Musk from his basic humanity, really, because I promise you I'm not a hippie. But if for somebody to say this, it means that they don't understand all of the artificial obstacles that have been put into place to keep the overwhelming majority of people dependent on physical labor, on jobs for basic survival, and that this system exists to help the wealthy become wealthier. And he doesn't understand that if those obstacles were removed, then it wouldn't be possible for him to become a billionaire in the first place. I'm not sure that he would be okay with that. And finally, that if a bot like this were to become real, it wouldn't mean that your mom and dad in their 30s, 40s, and 50s wouldn't have to go out and lay tar for a living. It means that billionaires like himself would happily pay $5 million each for one of these really, really exclusive little robots just so that they could fire somebody from a $30,000, $33,000 a year job for which they're not receiving medical benefits. That's exactly what would happen. It's this enormous amount of cluelessness that makes me think that it makes me fear that this person has any influence whatsoever on anything that happens in this world anywhere. That's what really gets up my nose, that cluelessness, that detachment from humanity that makes me just take my opinion of Elon Musk down a couple pegs. I am sorry for getting off on it.
It's okay. That was beautiful. Your 3 minutes is up now, Andy.
I'm in touch with my anger. I hope you enjoyed the song. And that's some of the edge off of angry Andy at the end. Okay.
You know, any chance we can interject musical theater anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Andy, thank you very much, though.
I'm available as of mid-October, by the way.
Okay. We liked your diatribe on Tesla as well. Thank you very much. And we'll talk soon.
Andy Inatko joins us regularly. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at inatko.com, and you can follow him at Inatko. I'll spell it too. It's I-H-N-A-T-K-O. Well, coming up, the joy of text. Poet Tracy K. Smith and conductor Marin Alsop join us to talk about giving Beethoven's Ninth Symphony a 21st century spin. That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan. And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston, hnews.org. Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jad Bowen's in for Jim Browdy. We're waiting for our next guest, a switch after Andy's diatribe about Tesla, an ode to joy. We're still waiting to connect with them. But before we do, I'm so happy about this. Ron DeSantis, who is the governor of Florida, is so into his craziness about COVID that he was going to take away salaries of school boards and school officials in Florida who were enforcing a mask mandate because tens of thousands of kids are being quarantined down there because they're exposed to COVID in the schools. Well, thank you very much, this Florida judge who just overruled DeSantis and said he cannot do it. He overstepped his authority. So those urban areas, particularly around Broward County, Miami, other parts of Florida where they're having the biggest epidemic. Well, actually, Mississippi and Alabama may be ahead of them at this point, but they're right up there. Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, this epidemic of this variant. Imagine that. He was going to fine them, take away their salaries. Well, he's been shot down by a Florida judge, so shout out to the Florida judge.
Which is difficult to understand how he can reconcile, again, some of the images we were talking about with Dr. Lamas earlier, when you're seeing hospitals yet again in the South having to convert garages and outdoor spaces into hospital wards because they just can't accept the patients because they have such an overflow and so unwilling to do all that they can to stop the transmission of this disease. So, yeah, that's welcome news. And I guess, as we see with the tide turning with businesses and lots of other people engaging in vaccine and mask requirements, that doing everything they can to change this.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this guy. He's a Florida 2nd District Circuit judge, but his name is John Cooper, so he's my hero of the day. Okay, we are switching gears now, a little joyous interlude here for a change. When Ludwig van Beethoven incorporated Friedrich Schiller's poem Ode to Joy into his 9th symphony, it was a call for equality, freedom, and brotherhood in celebration of the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. Carnegie Hall commissioned former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith to reimagine Schiller's poem as a contemporary meditation on community and politics and spirit. Tracy Smith was one of several poets commissioned for the Global Ode to Joy project, which is the creation of conductor Maren Alsop. This adaptation will be performed tonight at 7 o'clock with the Handel and Haydn Society at the Hatshell. And joining us to talk about this collaboration are both of these great artists, U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith and conductor Maren Alsop. Tracy Smith and Maren Alsop, thank you so much for being with us. I think they're with us. I hope they're with us. Are they with us?
Yes.
Great.
We're here. Great to be here.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on what sounds like an incredible event at the Hatshell tonight. So, Maren, let's start with you. Tell us about what you've been doing, this Ode to Joy thing that you have been doing, and what's happening tonight.
Sure. Well, this is really serendipitous that it came together for us to do this premiere of this beautiful new text that Tracy has composed. My idea was to celebrate Beethoven's 250th anniversary and reimagine his 9th symphony for the world that we inhabit. You know, the Schiller is beautiful, but it was very much of its time. And the issues confronting us today, while some are similar, of course, they resonate in different ways. And so that was part of this project, to have texts that were that felt really culturally relevant to the regions where I was doing the piece. And I think Tracy's text, you know, it brings together these themes of humanity and unity and joy, but also, I think, points out the issues that are confronting us, like the destruction of our planet and these kinds of issues that are overwhelmingly part of our existence today.
You know, and I should add, I don't know if you realize, but we had a little sneak preview because our show comes just a few studios away from where you have been rehearsing here at GBH
this
week.
Right.
So we would come out of our studio and hear this glorious music, so just to give audiences a sense of how what's in store for tonight. It's so beautiful. But Tracy, let's bring you in here and talk to us about how you approached this text as a poet, as a lover of literature, and diving into this project. What opportunity did you find?
Well, I have long been interested in looking at historical documents, and you know, a poem is something other than that, but it speaks from its period, and asking to hear something that could be useful to my own period or my own, you know, particular conditions. And so looking at Schiller's poem made me want to listen for touchstones that could be useful to the feelings that I believe are kind of like sources of unrest at this moment. And those are things like division, or as Marin mentioned, our imbalanced relationship with the planet, our outsized sense of who and what we are in any context that we humans seem to enter into. And so it was an exciting opportunity to try and bring new language to what exists in the text and what it speaks to or can speak to in the air around us now.
And what was your process for doing this? How long did you take, and what did you start to absorb to do this?
I don't remember how long it took, but I know that it was about sitting down and really listening. I would kind of have the English translation of Schiller's poem on one side of my screen, and I would work on the other side and try and think about what living English 21st century referent might activate or animate what exists in the original. And so the religious sense in the poem, the sense of brotherhood and community in the poem, that might feel effortless from this distance, I wanted to trouble a little bit. And I wanted to bring in a sense that perhaps our faith at this moment in human culture touches things that aren't necessarily what we think of as traditionally holy. And so the planet became one of those sources for me.
Marin, how will this happen tonight at the Hat Shell? The music and the poem. How will this work?
Well, this is really a fabulous opportunity this evening, because this will be the world premiere of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the brand new text by Tracy K. Smith. So you don't want to miss it. And it's been beautifully set, I think, to the music. Although I must confess, Tracy, that I took one artistic liberty. I hope you'll be all right with this. When the tenor begins singing, instead of saying let's find joy, I asked him to start with joy. So I hope that's okay, because it really vocally let's is a hard thing to say. Let's. The choir and the soloists have all really, I think, made this text part of the piece now. You know, at first it was a little bit awkward, because when you sing a piece that's so familiar with a text that, whether you really are conscious of what the translation even means, but it's something that has been part of your DNA, you know, since you were born, it's very interesting to try to rethink and make that new text part of who you are. So tonight, I thought it would be especially wonderful, since Tracy is here now and making Boston your home, right, Tracy? Am I right? That's really just a coincidence, sheer coincidence. So I was going to say a few words about the piece and what it means in these difficult times we've been through. And Tracy, I'm hoping will recite the text so that everyone can hear it before we do it in the context of the piece.
Well, Tracy, in thinking of Ode to Joy, like so many things during the pandemic, we're reconsidering things that we thought we knew. So what does joy mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love, Marin, even that you say sometimes you know the words, but do you really hear them? That right. Joy is one of those words, right? We hear it and we think, oh, it's happiness. Yes, I want that. But I like to think that joy has some of the sublime in it. and that it's a struggle, and it's an opportunity to break through something that might be comfortable into something that might be generative and productive. And, you know, I think that's hard to do in a context, you know, as simple as a family, as simple as, or as intimate as an intimate relationship. And certainly when the diameter gets bigger and bigger, it's hard to do that. But maybe that's why we ought to.
Well, Maren, I want to ask you the same question, because I know that you began this project not necessarily, obviously, with the pandemic in mind, but thinking that you were going to celebrate this on the occasion of Beethoven's 250th birthday, to do this on six continents, to have six different translators, or a number of different translators, I should say, look at this notion. So what is it about Ode to Joy that resonates with you in this moment, too? Or in how has it evolved for you since you conceived the project?
Well, of course, the pandemic was not even on my horizon radar. I mean, I never expected this, as no one did, I think. So the idea behind it really was to try to pull out the essence of Beethoven's philosophy, you know, because, I mean, Beethoven is one thing as a musical genius, that's fine, you know, but he also represents, I think, for me anyway, he takes on the role of a hero, someone who can overcome enormous personal tragedy and strife and still find optimism and hope for the future. And of course, as the pandemic unfolded, it seemed almost too appropriate that it would also be the same year as Beethoven's huge anniversary, because he comes to then symbolize this idea of isolation and being disconnected from humanity. Because as he lost his hearing, he became more and more alienated from the society that he was dying to connect with and humanity. And so I think, you know, in some ways it just feels fateful that this was the same year as the pandemic. And maybe from Beethoven, we can take something away about accepting, I think, limitations, accepting difficulties in life, and that progress is never a straight line, as we see today having to go back to masks. You know, we just need to try to, I think, bring ourselves out of ourselves and be part of humanity, share this unity. This idea of joy is a very complex one, a very simple one and a very complex one. But joy it's a galvanizing force. You know, when you create joy with a group of people, you have such incredible power. So maybe that's the takeaway for me.
We're talking about the Global Ode to Joy Project, the creation of conductor Maren Alsop. We're talking to Maren now. We're also talking to the former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, who has written a new interpretation of the poem to go with this, to go with the Ode to Joy. Tracy, I'm wondering if you can share some of that poem with our listeners. Read a few stanzas for us so we can get a sense of what you created.
Absolutely. I'll read two of the stanzas from early in the poem. Joy, bright God spark, born of ever, daughter of fresh paradise. Where you walked once, now walk rancor, greed, suspicion, anger, fright. Joy, the breeze off all that's holy, pure with terror, wild as flame. Make us brothers, give us comfort. Bid us past such fear and hate. If you've loved another's beauty, if you've craved the warmth of flesh, if your spirit is invested in another's sense of worth, lift your voice to touch my voice now. Let our song bring joy to earth.
We know why you're the poet laureate and the former poet laureate, Tracy Smith. The whole poem is absolutely incredible, Tracy K. Smith, Ode to Joy. You know, Tracy, before I get back to the music, you mentioned one of the stories I read about you, that as a poet laureate, you go around the country and you meet different groups of people and you speak to different people. And you were talking about being out in a rural area of the United States of America, and you're a Black woman. And there's a lot of tension around race, around politics, around everything. But correct me if I'm wrong, I had the sense that you were able to connect with people that are very different from you, that might have been surprised to even see you show up. So mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was this tremendous gift. And I was aware of, you know, my identity, the position that I occupy in many communities. And I didn't know what to expect, but I had hope. And I entered into spaces where I was a stranger. And I met other strangers who were eager to lean in, listen, share, kind of take the risk of talking about a poem that they just heard. And it was a beautiful, every single time we touched down in another community, in another part of the country, it felt like this amazing reminder that there's so much that sits beyond the momentary apprehension that, you know, sparks up between two people who are different, if we get there. I like poetry because it's quiet and it's slow, and it allows you, if you let it, to get to that other place where you're touching on something that's true for you, and you're offering it to somebody else to respond to with something that's genuinely true for them as well. It made me feel like our civic discourse needs a lot more poetry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If we read a poem a day, we wouldn't be at each other's throats all the time.
If we read a poem a day with someone else, I think
with
that
someone
was
else. That's a yeah. great, yeah.
And we're all craving community right now. We're all like eager to get back to how close we used to be. And so I think there are lots of ways we can hopefully begin to do that more and differently.
You know, Maren, likewise, you have just wrapped up a tenure leading the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and which was a challenge for you from what I've been reading. First of all, you were the only woman conductor of a major American orchestra. If I read correctly, you're also the only American leading a major American orchestra. I know a bit about the art scene in Baltimore from friends who were there, and I know how the museum there has tried to push back and disrupt. It sounds like you were trying to do the same too, to bring in more inclusivity. How did you find that experience?
Well, now there's a big question. I think that, you know, for me, and I think for any of us that have, you know, had challenges and had to struggle or look different from others in a field that we decided to pursue, I mean, it's a matter of being unrelenting, being kind but unrelenting in one's pursuit of the end goal. And also, I think it's so important that we set an example for the next generations and create more opportunities for people coming up than we had ourselves. So this is, you know, this is what I've tried to do. And probably, I mean, I'm very proud of the work I did in Baltimore with the orchestra. The orchestra sounds fabulous. So I'm very, very, very proud of that achievement. But I'm probably even prouder of the 2,000 kids from West and East Baltimore that are now playing musical instruments. Because in 2008, I started a program called Orchestra Kids, with 30 first graders. And now there are 2,000 kids playing. And many of them have just graduated from high school and are going into careers, believe it or not, in music. And, you know, so I feel that if we can give back in this way, you know, as a result of the challenges we've sort of come to terms with, then it's all worthwhile.
You know, Maren, I often wondered why there are so few women conductors. Is it because you can, you can't be the captain of the ship. Is that basically what this is about? Because they're really, I'm not a orchestra expert, but I was stunned that you were a woman actually leading tonight, because I see so few women leading orchestras.
Yeah, I think the statistics are something like it's more likely for a woman to lead a G7 nation, G8 nation, or to be become a 4-star general than to lead a major American orchestra. I mean, now that I did 14 years with Baltimore, and as I stepped down, there has still not been another woman. I mean, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. I think, you know, again, it's a matter of creating visuals that change that impression, you know, so people have to see more and more women. And in 2002, I started a fellowship for women conductors, and we now have 24 recipients and 19 music directorships. So they're coming along, and they're great, and they're diverse. You know, if you just see the same woman, if it's just me or if it's just someone else, that doesn't work. You know, we have to see women of different ages, different colors, different sizes, different nationalities. And I'm hoping that all of this recent social movements, which, you know, that's a whole other topic we could talk about, but I'm hoping at least the positivity that comes from those movements will change the landscape for the future.
Well, Tracy, I feel like there's something so similar in what you have done as well, in ways that young children might not be able to see themselves as musicians because they just don't have the experience to experience the opportunity to experience an orchestra or hear music. But then when it's introduced to them, of course, it's life changing. The same with what you've done as the U.S. Poet Laureate, to go into communities where people don't see themselves as writers or understand that they may have a facility for it. What do you see that you can tap into people? What have you seen change in people through your visits and your efforts?
Well, I won't claim that I've changed people, but I know that people in that setting who might ordinarily say, oh, I don't know anything about poetry. Poetry is a little bit too tricky for me. When we relax and share, remember poems that they loved growing up or that they used to write poems. And so sometimes you need to be in a space where you have permission to draw upon your whole self. You know, so much of our lives were spent sort of in the compartment that we've been told is the right compartment, that we forget the whole rest of the, you know, the entity that we each make. And so I love that in that setting, people were able to access something that they already had.
So tonight at the Hat Shell, it's going to be like the typical concert there, the blankets, the little chairs, everybody sitting outside. They don't have to be so worried about their masks because they will be outside in their little pods. That's what it's going to be tonight at the Hat Shell. Correct, Maren?
Yes. I mean, I've never been there, so I'm just imagining it, but that's the plan.
Yeah.
It's just going to be a normal outdoor concert and, you know, bring your wine and bring your whatever you want to bring and enjoy. That's the idea.
And Tracy, what's your role going to be?
Well, mostly I'm excited to listen and just receive, but yeah. I'll get to read the text. So maybe people will have an ear, you know, a head start, an ear start on what the text has become before they sort of give themselves over to the amazing force of the music.
And as we heard, a short commute for you. It's such a treat that you're a Bostonian now.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm excited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations to you both. And thank you so much for being here. It looks like the weather's going to hold. There's not going to be any rain. I don't think so. It looks like it's going to be a nice, warm day by the river. So it'll be beautiful.
And we love to share this. It's free.
It's free. Oh, yes.
On the Esplanade.
That's very important. It is free. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. We much appreciate your time.
Thank you. Yeah, great. See you later, Tracy.
See you soon.
Bye.
Yeah, just a few hours away. We've been speaking with former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith and conductor Maren Alsop. Tracy K. Smith has written new lyrics for Ode to Joy as part of the Global Ode to Joy Project, a creation of conductor Maren Alsop. It'll be formed tonight by the Handel and Haydn Society at 7 o'clock at the Hat Shell. And as we said, it is free. To learn more, go to handelandhaydn.org. Well, coming up, how did the golden age of Alex Trebek get tarnished in a search for a new Jeopardy host? And does it matter? Callie Crossley joins us for that and more on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jack Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. So, the Jeopardy saga continues, with Michael Richards stepping down after a really short-lived stint as Jeopardy's new host. Are all the headlines this is generating a reflection of our search to think about something other than COVID and climate, or does this controversy actually matter? Joining us for her take on this and other stories that have gone over and under the radar is Callie Crossley. She's host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie Crossley.
Hello, Marjorie. Hello, Jared.
Hello. Hi, Callie.
Hello, Callie Crossley. Yes. I can't believe how many times you mentioned the legendary deviled egg contest among the three of us. Remember that, Callie? We always point out.
Oh, I always do. I have many egg plates at home.
She does. And she kicked our behind.
Says the victor modestly.
Yes, I'm so modest.
You know what?
Things.
Maybe we have to have a rematch at some point. I have acquired some new deviled egg tray plates,
okay,
since, including one from Salzburg. Uh-huh.
Oh, look at you.
You probably
don't have as many as I have, but, you know, I digress.
I see that lack of modesty continues.
She rolled in. I'll never forget it. She comes rolling in with like this whole big, it was like a moving van full of plates.
Just a modest little ode to the egg.
But anyway, I did not know Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had a second skill. I see stuff written by him all the time. Yeah, he's a brilliant writer, and he
really
weighed
is.
In on the very, very short-lived reign, if you can call it that, of Michael Richards as the guy to follow up Alex Trebek on Jeopardy. So tell us what he had to say about this Jeopardy debacle.
Yeah. So first, to your point, he's a really good writer.
He is really good.
So if you have in your mind, you know, sort of these jock, dumb, you know, equations, I guess you're wrong, except when it comes to him, because this is, all of his stuff is incredibly written. And, you know, a lot of people have talked about this. We've talked about it to some degree here. But I was taken with his point. And his point was that it was a travesty, not only because they gave in to all the stuff we talked about, you know, doing the stuff behind the backs and, you know, not saying they had an inside candidate, blah, blah, blah. But his point is that this is a show that held in high regard knowledge.
Yeah.
That held in high regard people who came to play the game to be smart. And that he compared it to other, he says, there's nothing wrong with the other games that are, you know, just for, you know, knock somebody on the head with a mallet and run a long mile or whatever. He's not like dissing those. He's saying those are fun and entertaining. He said, but in a space where we have so few places where we are elevating the intellect and the importance of actually knowing some things that can be documented, this really was important in that way. And I just thought that is, you know, it was like, wow, this is right. And think of it that way. And he talked about how Alex Trebek really worked within that context of, you know, having a real discussion with people about what they knew and what he knew and what the answer was and all of that. And that, as he says, we've been in an assault against intelligence and critical thinking in the way that the country has faced in the recent years. So just having somebody that wanted to and for the whole country to follow them, wanted to say, it's okay. It's not only is it okay to be smart, but it's important to be smart and it's fun to be smart. And so I thought this was really quite something. And then he goes on to say, who knew he had competed on Jeopardy? And he did it to make the point that jocks are not stupid. And he encouraged other jocks. And remember Aaron Rodgers, the football player.
He won, right?
Well, was one of the, I don't remember if he won or not, but he was one of the people who subbed and allegedly was up for the job.
I thought he was great, too.
Yeah, he was great and before people, you know, knew the fix was in. But I thought this was a great take, one that should be said, and he said it beautifully. So
And it looks to be further bungled. I don't understand why more people aren't talking about the fact that Mayim Bialik was essentially chosen as the number two because they tapped her to do these other specials. So she was tapped to be number two. Why doesn't she become number one now that Mike Richards is out?
Well, remember when we talked about it before, I said I assumed, having no information, and I think it's been confirmed in a couple pieces, that she had all these other things going, and so that she didn't have a schedule where she could just do it. But now I understand that they're working around her schedule, which they could have done from the beginning, to your point. And so that she, you know, because Alex Trebek didn't do a show a day. He bundled them up. So they could bundle around her schedule as well. For that matter, they could bundle around anybody's schedule. So if they wanted to. So it just depends on, you know, what they decide to do. But, you know, this is really, I just thought, go ahead, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And if people are trying to think, who is that? He would have been kind of the LeBron James of his time.
Oh, my God. Yes, he was huge.
Yes. So just so people have a sense of why are we paying attention to what he has to say and why this is a moment. And that's why.
So nothing makes me happier, Callie Cross, than talking about the hypocrisy of my former boss, Rupert Murdoch.
Wow.
Give us the latest.
This is really something. So both the New York Post, that people know in New York, the paper, and then Fox News itself, you know, the channel, have just been, I mean, this is just brazen hypocrisy. So as we know that if you read the Post, let's start there. They have been railing, questioning mask mandates, asserting they're not necessary, particularly for vaccinated people. When the CDC said in July they was recommending vaccinated people wear a mask in areas with substantial and high community transmission, the Post called it madness. This is nonsense and pernicious to the Post editorial board. The Post editorial board. Just want to say that again. Okay, well, now they have a requirement that all of their employees wear masks inside. Masks are required while walking the floor, not at your desk, according to
me.
And you must cover up at all times. This is, you know, completely opposite of what they're saying what they're railing about in the editorial pages and in the news pages. Also, the right-wing channel Fox News, and we know all of their top personalities. We're talking to Sean Hannity's and what's the other guy's name?
Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson. Railing, how dare you ask me about my vaccination status, said Tucker Carlson. That's akin to asking him about his sex life. Sean Hannity repeatedly talked up the doctor-patient confidentiality. Fox News says, you need to tell us all employees must enter their status, their vaccination status, no later than August the 17th. And they're requiring employees to wear a mask in small, confined spaces. This, again, is completely opposite of what they've been saying on the air. By the way, they did not respond to the reporter at CNN who was asking them to comment about the discrepancy between the rhetoric from the channel's top stars and its own internal policies. So this from a place that's been ranting about, you know, this is anti-American and a threat to personal freedom. But I guess they're not that free when the boss says, you need to do this.
Says, wear your mask until you sit down and take your mask off and tell all the other people to wear their mask.
That's right.
Exactly.
And you don't get in here with your proof of vaccination. You don't get in here.
Right.
Period. I mean, I just love it. It doesn't get any better than that, does it?
No. But here's the thing. So you know this, and we know this, because we're reading other sources. The people that read the Post exclusively or watch Fox News exclusively don't know this.
Right.
So they're still listening to this, listening to the freedom, listening to the don't ask me because you're challenging. It's like asking me about my sex life, blah, blah, blah. And they don't know that all those people sitting in those chairs and the people behind the scenes have all been required to do so and are doing so.
Well, Tucker Carlson's gone on and on about these crazy vaccination conspiracy theories.
It's really, you know, and they don't mind being hypocritical, as we've said. They don't mind at all. They just keep going forward. So it's incumbent upon the rest of us to keep shouting it to the rooftops, even if the other people don't know.
So, Callie Crossey, I think the worst nightmare many of us have is that somehow we win the Powerball.
Thank you.
And we're ready to get $500 million, and then we lose the ticket, right?
Yes.
Or we get run over by a bus and we're in the hospital.
Yes.
We don't get
or someone
there
steals
in
it.
Time to claim our yes.
Or you put it to the wash.
Yeah. Yes. What happened in Massachusetts with the Vax Millions?
This is my nightmare, I just need to say. Because I'm so diligent about these daggone robocalls.
Yeah.
And I block calls all the time. So this time, in this period of time when they're announcing winners, I've been letting stuff go through and answering it because it could be my millions and I only have 24 hours to answer. Some poor sucker won and did not respond in 24 hours, and so they moved to the next person.
Can you
no,
imagine?
I know.
Do
no.
not think that I didn't go through my junk, my spam filters to make sure that I wasn't the one.
Exactly.
Can you imagine? It would be better not to know.
I know.
It would be better just not. I hope that person just somehow is in a temporary coma or
well,
something.
Well, they don't
like that.
Tell you, right? They just, you know, you don't know unless you go back and see it as Jared said.
Yeah,
so you would be
so
nowhere for you to know.
Stupid of me because I thought, why am I doing this? What if I found out that I.
Yeah,
I lost?
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. Because you would have the email saying, call us. Call us by the end of the call us again by the end of the day.
But I keep resting on this, Jared. They said you had to turn in, remember, two email addresses?
Uh huh.
So I checked both of them, make sure, because that was the backup too. So you had the two email addresses and then they had the phone number. So here I am answering the stupid robocalls, hoping and looking at the email and nothing. And this guy, they go right for him and he misses it. I'm saying it's a he. It could be a woman. I don't know.
It could be. We don't know.
We don't know. They also said it could have been the person that missed out on the scholarship money, which would be even really sad. Yeah.
You know? That, I really like that. They were including the scholarship things. What was it, $300,000 toward a college education?
Yes.
And it's close to $300,000 now when you think about it.
Remember the first winner? The first winner said she couldn't have gone.
Yeah.
It was a really wonderful story that, you know, she won the scholarship and could now go on to college. I mean, you know.
Well, Jim is always ranting how regressive these lotteries are. And
I wanted to regress to me.
You know, exactly. Well,
if I may say.
But you know something?
What?
Usually the people that win they're not living in Weston and Wellesley.
Yeah, right.
They're living in Brockton or Chelsea or something. And their whole life can be changed. Although then you do read those stories, Callie, about how things go south.
Well, sometimes. But I used to watch this show called Lottery Millions or something, and very interesting stories about people who actually did hold on, did interesting things.
Oh, good.
It was an 18-year-old guy that won. You know, you're right at the age. There's an age limit where you can win. He won a ridiculous amount. He's like won like the Powerball or something. And he bought his parents a house and stuff. But he left school initially because he always had an idea for several companies. Moved to another state, built the companies, made more money, and then said, you know, I should go back to school. Went back, moved back home with mom in the big house he bought her, and went back to school.
That's very impressive.
It is very impressive.
There are about 1,000 other people who buy 14 boats and are bankrupt within 6 months.
I just want to know that in that 6 months, whoever you are, Vax Millionaire, can I ride on the boat? Can I go to the just a little taste of it, you know, since I'm not going to get it.
Okay.
Wow, that kills me. I just tell you, that is. Yeah. Oof.
So we get the Proud Boy leader going to jail for his role in the January 6th. I don't think he got that much time, though. Did he? What did he get?
Six months. Looks 155 days, I thought, was kind of chintzy. Then I read it, and it's actually a little bit more than 5 months. So this is Enrico Tarrio, also known as, what's the guy's first name? I can't think of it. Henry, who pleaded guilty to destroying property, burning down the Black Lives Matter flag on the Ashbury United Methodist Church. This was a church in Washington, D.C. He did this deed while he was in town with weapons he wasn't supposed to have in Washington, D.C. for the Capitol riots. You know, he was big and bad on the email, as we've seen, saying, I'm damn proud I did it. So they obviously could find him. The senior pastor at the church spoke at the court hearing and called his conduct an act of intimidation and racism, and that he treated his action as a trophy on social media. This has been established as a hate crime, which is why he is spending some time. Here's what's interesting, just so people know. Mr. Tarrio, who was damn proud he did it, apologized. In fact, this piece says he was full of apologies. He just apologized all over the place. He just knew he was wrong now and wished he hadn't done it. He told the court, what I did was wrong. Many times he apologized. The whole question about hate crimes, as we know, keeps coming up about what constitutes a hate crime and doesn't. We should note that on our own website just earlier this week, we had a piece about with our Daniel Medved, our legal expert talking about the fact that there's a new report about hate crimes, and that they what they know about it, what they can document, is actually the very, very tip of the iceberg. So there's a lot of more of these Tarios doing more than burning down a Black Lives Matter flag than we know about. But at least in this case, he's spending at least 6 months in jail.
What's on the Callie Crossley, under the radar of Callie Crossley?
Well, we are looking at the zero waste movement, and it is being really sparked by Gen Zers. They're like all about, let's get to zero waste. And so we talked to not only the young woman who has the shop, the only shop in the country here in Boston, but also some other Gen Zers who are really pushing zero waste. And as I said to my colleagues earlier this morning, I wanted to know from them if they were able to get all of their waste. You know that you've seen that mason jar test where you're supposed to get all your waste from a year in one mason jar. I just wanted to know if they could do that because I'm so far from the mason jar.
Oh, my God.
So everybody can tune in and hear what their answer is. So that's one part of the show. The second part of the show is Professor David Gessner, who is has written many, many books about the environment. And, and he, at the same time that the COVID was going on, saw the connections with Thoreau and did a whole thing about not just the isolation. That's very obvious. His he was isolated on Walden Pond. We were isolated. But he really talked about it wasn't a simple kind of kooky guy there. It really was about also his connection to community, which in the end is what happened to us as we were dealing with this COVID infection. So we have Professor David Gessner and his book about David Thoreau and its connection to David Thoreau and his connection to the COVID pandemic and what he teaches us, and also zero waste.
Well, thank you. Excellent. Callie Crossley is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can catch it Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. And you can subscribe to the Under the Radar podcast. Coming up, Larger Than Life photo exhibit zooms in on the larger than life stories of Boston's mayoral candidates. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. So one of the failures of our education system is the school-to-prison pipeline, the trend where kids of color and lower-income students are disproportionately disciplined, funneled out of public schools and into the juvenile and criminal justice systems. College Bound Dorchester is the practice of reverse engineering this by creating a prison-to-school pipeline. To that end, they also have a new initiative which focuses on getting gang members off the corner and into the classroom. It's called Boston Uncornered. Since 2019, Boston Uncornered has created a public art exhibit, a series of towering black and white portraits of former gang members, business leaders, and this year, all the mayoral candidates whose stories and diversity have made this Boston race an historic one. It's on view now through September 15th at the Sea Green Park in the Seaport District. Joining us to talk about this are Michelle Caldara, co-founder of Boston Uncornered, and John Hewitt, a renowned celebrity photographer and athletic photographer, best known for his portraits of those professional athletes. Michelle Caldara and John Hewitt, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Marjorie, thank you for having us. Hi, Jared.
Hi.
So, Michelle, let's start with you. Before you tell us what you got going on down there in the Seaport, what does it mean to be uncornered in Boston Uncornered?
Absolutely. So uncornered means, you know, one of the things I like to say is that our young people are no different than you and me. They have hopes and dreams. They just haven't had the resources and opportunities to achieve their success, as many of us have. And so being uncornered means finding ways to tap into the potential and brilliance that each of us have as individuals. So figuratively tapping into the potential of young people that we engage with, and literally supporting them in moving from the corner to college. So being uncornered is a, you know, it can mean different things.
Well, we'll talk more in a moment about what they tell you and some of their thoughts that are expressed in this series. But John, let me bring you in here and ask you, what it's like to see these individuals as you photograph them and put them on view, as Marjorie said, in these towering portraits that really, as I love to find in the arts, it requires slow looking as you engage with the portraits.
It's this whole project that we've been working on this now for almost 3 years, almost it seems like that.
Three, I think, John, yeah.
And it has been a slow process. We do this a little bit at a time. They're not all done on the same day. And what really attracted me to this project was the fact that we were going to treat everybody the same. Whether they were a gang member or they were the mayor of Boston. And I try to do that when I photographed everybody, is I never really talked to anybody about their story beforehand, because I didn't want to have any sort of preconceived sort of thing going into this, or thought of like, oh, this is a gang member, or I have some sort of prejudice against him or something like that, or what happened with somebody in their the political leader and their what they've done in their life. I just, when they walked in, everybody's been treated the same. It's not a very big photo shoot. There's very little fanfare. It's usually just myself and the subject. And we just sit and talk. And what's refreshing and really fun for me is the fact that there is really this sort of across the board, everybody's is the same. We talk about the same things. We have the same ideas. And that's when you go down and you look at the photographs and you read the stories, you start to realize that, yes, everybody in these pictures has problems and has things that they had to overcome. Some are bigger than others, but still to that person, that was a big part of their life. And so that to me was the reason I will keep doing this as long as they'll ask me to do it, because it's just, I have met the most interesting people in Boston that I've ever met.
Well, one of the neat things when you go down to see Boston corner of the Seaport District, you see these huge towering photographs, which are huge and towering, but you also see these little placards next to them talking about how they themselves, the people in this exhibit, became uncornered. So let's start with some of the candidates running for mayor, Michelle. What kind of things did they say?
Well, some of the candidates, you know, we've heard their stump speeches, we've heard their we've seen their policy platforms, and we know a little bit about their stories. You know, we know the current acting mayor, Janey, was a teen parent. But what she shared was that her uncornered moment is sitting down and sharing that she was pregnant with her dad, and what that meant for her and how that felt for her. We know about Councillor Andrea Campbell's story about her twin brother. Well, some of us do, right? But we don't know that moment when she felt like she was about to lose her twin brother and what that felt like for her. So those are the things that we learn about the candidates and about their stories. That are both inspiring and powerful, I think, at the same time.
What's the point of asking these questions and gaining the trust of these individuals to share what they're sharing with you, often very difficult moments?
Yep. So one of the things that we want to do at Uncornered is to amplify stories and show, again, like John said, that people are the same. We've all had struggles and things that we've had to overcome. And so for our young people to see that the mayor of Boston, that an elected official, that Devin McCourty, who was a part of the project as well, that Congresswoman Presley, who was a part of the project, has had challenges that they've had to overcome, you know, and what that meant for them, that I think it shows that there's hope for our young people as well.
You know, John, you, as I said in the introduction, you're known for a lot of your great photographs of professional athletes, Serena Williams, hockey players. You have that great picture of Katie Ledecky, the swimmer. I mean, were you underwater? Did you take that picture underwater? It looks like you are underwater.
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
Okay. Well, so those are obviously action shots. How is it different as a photographer, what you did down at the seaport and what you are probably best well known for?
Well, the funny thing is that I never started out as a sort of sports, quote unquote, photographer. And I don't really consider myself a sports photographer.
Oh, because, sorry.
No. Because there are the guys who do it. The men and women do it every day who are on a sideline and catching action. That the stuff is just amazing how they do that. And I do that. The only time I shoot a live sporting event is I do the Olympics every 2 years. And that's my chance to actually like what I would consider a sports photographer. I started out more as an advertising photographer. And so shooting portraits is something that I've always done and I always like doing. And it's the best part of it is the one-on-one with the subject.
But I love to ask artists who work in many different realms, does photographing the Olympics, does some of that translate into how you shoot your portraits? What carries through?
Well, I think that I always say that I'm a photographer. So I try to carry whatever is in front of my camera, I try to treat it the same way across the board. But I do take things from like what I just got done doing it in Tokyo, which I'm still in the middle of editing the images. I'll take stuff that I learned from that and I'll apply it to a different photo shoot. I mean, it could be shooting a child, or I could be shooting a portrait, or I could be shooting an advertisement, but I'll use some of that. And then vice versa, the stuff that I apply when I'm shooting a commercial ad, I'll apply that to the Olympics or to sports, to live sports. So that gives it kind of hopefully gives my look, a signature look to my photographs. And so there's a narrative thread running through all of it.
We're talking to Michelle. I'm sorry, Michelle, go ahead.
Sorry, Marjorie, if I can add, one of the comments that I've received about folks viewing the different portraits in this project is a sense that they can see the emotion of the folks, of the participants, and they can almost feel and see the personality of the different individuals that are photographed by John. So I think that connection there, you can see something happening, even though it's a still photo.
Well, I said this to Jared before while we were waiting to speak with you. We had Robert Lewis and Rudy Hippolyte in here last week who just did this documentary mm-hmm. about gangs in Boston, that this ain't normal. It's fantastic. It's on Showtime now. And it really showed you the charisma of a lot of these young men, the brains of these young men. They were leaders of crime in their neighborhood, but there were a lot of options for these kids, and it just shows you how talented these young men are, which I think is something most people, certainly people that are living in the suburbs or white people, don't see. And I was so struck just showing the difficulties that these young men overcome by some of what they said. There was this kid young man, Giovanni Morris, who wrote his parents were in and out of jail for most of his childhood, so he felt unwanted. There was another a young man, Tito, who talked about how his best friend was killed over a pair of boots. The one that got to me, especially this year, because I've been so critical of police officers, I'll say something nice about cops here, this Antonio Franklin, who said uh-huh. he spent 10 years in prison for shooting involving a police officer, and at his sentencing, that police officer spoke on his behalf and said he thought Antonio was a good kid who could get better. And Antonio talked about how his forgiveness and belief in him allowed him to be uncornered. You are so successful, both you, John, as a photographer, and Michelle, in picking these young men. I think in helping people understand what these young men's life has been like.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I want to say, Robert Lewis is a mentor of mine, and we have learned a ton from Street Safe in the work that he's done over the years. with Uncornered. I'm glad you mentioned Antonio's story. I think that's exactly right in the power. I actually had the opportunity to witness Antonio and that police officer meeting for the first time a few years ago. After that incident, after Antonio spent time in prison for that incident, and that police officer showing grace and forgiveness, and that meeting was something to see. It was inspiring. It was, you know, the idea that in the police officer, you know, doesn't want to be well known, but he, you know, he felt the same way. And he said, I knew that you could be successful if you were given an opportunity. And now I see you with Boston Uncornered, enrolled at Bunker Hill Community College, yeah, doing, you know, taking care of your family, doing the things I knew that you could do if you were given that opportunity.
John, I'm curious what your experience has been throughout the years that you've been doing this project now. I think many of us would have, to Marjorie's point, when you hear the words, quote-unquote, gang member, you have a conception of who that person is as a character and personality. Who do you see come into your studio and leave your studio?
I see very accomplished young people.
Yeah.
It's really been refreshing and I can't the best way to describe it, but there's a certain charisma that they've all walked in with, whether they wanted their picture taken or, and you know, the first thing is everybody says, oh, I hate getting my picture taken. But once that sort of initial sort of nervousness goes away, there's a presence. And I hope that it translated into the photographs. And I think it has that these young people have that they're not somebody who, I would say, you know, if I was walking down the street, I would cross the street because I'd be nervous. But
yeah,
Now I just walk up to these guys and greet them. And as I do now, they're all the most what's the best way to say this? They are, as a group, this is a very loving and caring group of really incredible individuals.
Well, I want to say congratulations to you both, because it is a fantastic exhibit. I think it's worth everybody's getting down there to visit. It's also a nice picture of you, Michelle. Notice that one right in there. So thank you.
There is. I've been honored to be photographed by John and be able to share my story as well. And just really, really proud to be part of this organization that is about unlocking potential and that's what we want to do, and I think we're on our way.
Well, thank you so much for joining both of you, and it's fantastic what you've done down there at the Seaport. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, Marjorie. Thank you, Marjorie and Jared.
Congratulations.
Nice meeting both of you guys.
Thank you.
Michelle Kodara is the co-founder of Boston Uncornered. John Mewitt is a renowned celebrity photographer best known for his portraits of professional athletes. The Boston Uncornered large portrait exhibit is on view now through September 15th at the Sea Green Park at the Seaport District. And thanks again to Michelle Caldera and John Hewitt. We are done, Jared Bowen.
We are done.
Thank you very much.
For toast.
For listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, and Rebecca Tauber. We want to thank our engineer as well, Bill Piccitelli. And I want to thank you, Jared Bowen, for filling in this week for Jim Browdy.
It's my pleasure to be with you all week, Marjorie. Always a treat.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jared Bowen.
Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you have a great weekend. Hope you can tune in again on Monday.